All right, today we have got Steve Rafe, and his is a story of many stories of massive names in the criminal community, as well as his own story himself, because he is a prolific author about key names in the underworld. He was a doorman for decades, head doorman, got his doorman business. And stories from Spain, Ibiza, the rave scene. So we've got a big one today. What were, I mean, all these links are in the description box below this video. Who are the people you wrote your books about? Let me just ask you that before we get to your story.
Written a lot of books over the years. Worked with Stephen Sears, obviously, from Newcastle. Paul Ferris, the wee man from Glasgow. Charles Salvador, a.k.a. Charles Bronson. Worked on a couple of books with him. Worked with the football hooligans in Newcastle, the NME, the Bender Squad and the Gremlins to do their book. Work with a lot of, you know, well-known people, all former villains and, you know, people who wanted to get their story out there who maybe, you know, couldn't have done it with bigger publishers.
And how many of those characters have had their stories turned into movies or are going to be turned into movies?
Yeah, most of them. Stevens is in post-production at the moment. We're busy working on, you know, the script and various, you know, various casting with that. Paul Ferris obviously had the wee man out there. Freddie Foreman's script has been written for his film with Ray Burdus. He's currently, you know, working on a second draft of that. Obviously, Bronson was played by Tom Hardy. He's already had his film out. So, yeah, all of these people, you know, they're very high profile, you know, in their line of work.
Yeah, you must be a diligent worker because every author, it's their pipe dream that the book's going to become a movie.
Yeah.
And to get to that level takes a lot of hard work, which people don't see, and connections, and being able to dismiss all the people who blow smoke up your ass over the years as well. Imagine you've had a bit of that.
Yeah, it's difficult. I think as far as being a publisher and a writer is concerned, it's difficult really to say, you know, yes to everybody because, you know, everyone has got a story to tell. There's a book in everybody, you know, whether they're a criminal or not. And that's the hardest part. You do get sent manuscripts, you get sent chapters, you get, you know, sent, you know, scribblings on bits of paper by people and everyone thinks that their story, you know, should be told. And it's not the case, sadly, you know, we can't help everybody. But there are some stories that, you know, will work and it's, you know, that's the hard part. It's like being the Simon Cowell, I suppose, of the book industry. You know, you have to be the judge and the jury on it and you have to decide which you think's going to sell. Because ultimately, as the publisher, you know, and the writer, I'm having to take time in making sure that we can put the book together. But then we have to pay for the publication and get it out there and then promote it and make sure it sells. We're not in the same position. You know, my company, Bad Boys Books, basically, we're not in that position to essentially take a risk on every single person's story because they won't all sell. And we can't give an advance. So you might go to somebody like John Blake Publishing, who a lot of criminals did in the past, reformed criminals, and they would be able to pay in advance and then, you know, essentially give them a small percentage of the book sales. We can't give an advance on any of the books, but what we can do is offer a better percentage for people. So, yeah, it's an attractive option for people. They know that working with me that they will get, you know, the right kind of exposure and they know that they'll get the right kind of effort put in. And, you know, if the book's good enough and the story's good enough, of course, there is the possibility of a film, but there's no guarantee. And I think with films, it's even harder because, you know, it's the financing of a film that's really hard. As you know, you find that even with somebody like Freddie Foreman's film, which I'm sure will be made in due course, you still need good finance. You want a film like, you know, Freddie's or Stephen Sears to be at a certain level. You don't want it to be straight to DVD and ending up in the bargain bin at a shop.
Yeah.
You want it to be, you know, you want it to be the same kind of budget as maybe the Long Good Friday or Get Carter or even Legend that Tom Hardy did recently about the craze. You want it to look good, and to do that, you need money.
So before we get to stories of all these major underworld figures and your relationships with them then, you were at the top of the bouncing field for decades. What does it take to be a good bouncer, to have that position and not to end up like getting major injuries and ending up in prison and all that, all the pitfalls?
For me, you know, I never ever thought I would walk into that industry at all. It wasn't a pre-plan. You know, from an early age, I always wanted to be an actor. You know, my first acting was at 7 years of age at school. And then I went to a drama class from the ages of 11 until 16 on a Saturday morning. So I wasn't even concentrating on any occupation other than being an actor. The doorman side of things basically came through going out on a night out with my football team every Sunday. We always used to go to a place called Masters in Newcastle, which is now Tup Tup Nightclub. And we essentially would go in and my mates would either fall out with themselves and have a fight, or they would fall out with other people and have a fight. And I would never get stuck in and have a fight with anybody. I would always end up jumping in and stopping my friends getting hurt or pulling them away and stopping them hitting people. So this one particular weekend, Gary, the head doorman, came up to us and he said, "Steve, he says, can I have a word with you?" He knew who we were. And he just said, "Look," he says, "I don't know if you fancy it," he says, "but there's a door shift coming up over Christmas." He says, "One of the lads has broken his arm." He says, "It'd be £25 an hour." And he said, "You've got, you know, a share of the Christmas bucket." And the Christmas bucket, of course, I'm not sure if there's the same in Liverpool and London and whatever, but in Newcastle, essentially, it was, you know, a bucket on the door at Christmas. And they always used to say it was for an injured doorman. But, of course, it all used to just get split between all the doormen. You know, it was that Christmas bonus, basically. Yeah. So that was the offer. I thought he was mad offering me the opportunity, but I gave it a bit of thought. And the following weekend, I said yes. So he gave us a Friday and a Saturday, Sunday over the Christmas. And this was, you know, coming into the mid-90s. And, I did it and I loved it. The first night I went on the doors, I got taken like around the bar 7 o'clock at night. And I remember walking through and it was very quiet. And this bar, Masters, was always a starting place and a finishing place. So people would start at 7, and then in the old licensing laws, it used to shut at 10:30. So people would come back at 10 o'clock and finish the night off there. And it was always full of it was the place to be seen, but it was always like the Newcastle players would always come in. So there was a bit of celeb there in there as well. So we got there at 7 o'clock. It was dead. He showed us around, showed us the fire exit, showed us where I'd be working, and showed us the light system. And you had a different light system for different parts of the bar. So, you know, red was front door, green was centre bar, and yellow was the back door, which is where I'd be working. And basically, these lights went off, all the doormen had to run from their positions to where the fight was. So that was the only thing I had to really take in, plus where I had to clock in and clock out, obviously, for me shift.
It's pretty important to know your light then, isn't it?
Yeah.
You don't be pressing the wrong
button. Because I wasn't colourblind.
So, but
we got there too early. The manager just welcomed us in and he said, "Look," he says, "if you want to go off for an hour," he says, "you can't really start yet." He says, "Get yourself away with a head doorman. I'm sure he'll take you somewhere beforehand." So he did. He took us to the Bridge Hotel at 7:15. And we were there for 45 minutes and he ended up doing 6 pints of Guinness in. So obviously wanting to impress the guy because it's my head doorman and it's my first night, I tried to, you know, keep up with him pint for pint. I had 6 pints of Guinness as well. Worst thing I could possibly do before my first night on the door. For the rest of the night, we got back to the bar, it was chock-a-block, absolutely, you know, stowed off. I had a headache, I felt sick, I had to keep going to the toilet. A bad start to my door career, but a valuable lesson learned. You know, I just thought, never ever will I drink again before a shift. But I got through it, I enjoyed it, I enjoyed the buzz, I enjoyed the attention from the women, because I was single at that time. And obviously got a chance to meet my heroes because Newcastle United players were coming in. So the likes of Lee Clark and Steve Watson, who were up-and-coming players at the time, were coming into the venue. They were coming into the back fire exit where I was working, so I was letting them in. So I was doing my heroes a favour, and it just became a dream job within the space of that first 4.5-hour shift. I really, really enjoyed it. So that was it. And the violence was... You know, the violence was there. You know, it was a team. So, like, what I felt as soon as the buzzer went off for that first bit of bother that night, it was a fight between three people in the bar. We all got there exactly as I had been doing with my football team when they were kicking off, getting somebody, grabbing somebody, getting them in a headlock and pulling them off, trying to calm them down, and then getting them out the venue. And that was it. The door career had started, and I really loved it.
So, how do you do that efficiently then? Without going overboard, because like in prison, there's guards who come in, you know, and they've got the power and they abuse it. And sometimes you see bouncers have got that cocky edge about them. You strike me as more of a diplomatic person, a thinker. You calculate things. How did that personality play into it? in the long run?
I haven't got a violent bone in my body. I think that's probably the. I think that's probably it. I think we can all have a temper. We've all got a breaking point. But I've got no malice or anger in me, and I have no bad intentions. I don't want to go out and hurt anybody. So, and I think as well, you know, my schooling at the time. You know, when I went to junior school. This junior school I went to, I couldn't read and write 2 years into school. So my mum and dad moved us out of state education and put us into private education at a young age. My mother employed somebody to give us elocution lessons, and she put us into poetry competitions. So from a young age, I was disciplined in learning words, and it got us back on track as far as my education was concerned. But in later life, it obviously developed, my talking skills developed. And I think the one thing my mum and dad wanted to do was give us that opportunity to be able to have a conversation and be able to speak and think and a decent use of the English language. So I think that's basically how I ended up working on the doors. You know, I was a big lad, always been, you know, quite hefty, 6'2", carried a bit more weight back in the days because I used to train. But from my perspective, I could always put across my point of view. So I didn't always go in and grab somebody. I would go in and try and stop it, you know. The sight of me running towards them, maybe with one or two other big lumps, you know, would often stop people in their tracks. And, you know, I would go in and, you know, I could shout at them, hey, stop, you know, and that would it. It would be enough sometimes. But those people who maybe were, you know, on drugs or too drunk to care about me coming across, if I had to get, you know, involved, then I would, you know, and restraining people. I never panicked. I never worried. I didn't jump into those situations with any, you know, worry. I just got involved. It was an instinctive thing. So, it was the right job for me, you know.
Words will get you out of, you talk your way out of it. It's best to do that, isn't it?
Oh yeah, 100%. And I think most people did.
Yeah.
But, you know, football hooligans who acted in groups, you know, or big groups of Asians, which we used to have problems with in the day.
But if you get them one-on-one, they're quiet as a mouse.
Yeah, or stag dudes from Ireland, you know what I mean? Big groups of lads, that's what you would end up with. Big, you know, any stag group you ended up with, you know, they would have a go at you, you know. But it was about being a part of a team, and I think that was what I enjoyed as well. It wasn't just you on your own, door lads working together, and doing the job properly was important. I did have one incident at Masters, though, and it was very early into my door career where, you know, there'd been a bit of bother on the front door. A group of people from Gateshead said they were going to come back. When I finished, the guys were like, they'll be back tomorrow, you know, and they'll be tooled up, so make sure you bring something in, you know. And I was going, bring something in? They're going, yeah, you need to bring a tool in, you know. And I was going, I'm not bringing anything in, like, you know. I got falling sick.
Yeah, well,
you're getting this thought of, like, you know, they're being serious here, you know.
Yeah.
Or is it like the old joke, you know, you're getting sent for a long stand, or you're getting sent to get some tartan paint. Is it a wind-up because I'm the new lad? But sure enough, the next night, the lads all turned up and they all had koshers and various things, knuckle dusters on them, and I didn't have anything. But the guys from Gateshead did turn back up. But I think, again, it was that camaraderie. We were all connected with radios. And, you know, there was about 20 of these lads turned up from Gateshead. There was 8 of us on the door. Got all the doormen on the front door. It was a bit of a Mexican standoff. And then those lads came towards us. But on the radio, Gary had notified the rest of the bars who were linked to us, and within seconds there was about 30 other doormen down, and it became a free-for-all in the street. The lads got what they deserved.
So all the doormen looked after one another, like taxi drivers.
And then, 100%. And this is before licensing. This is before the licensing came in. It was all for one and one for all, you know. Everybody stuck in, and there was a camaraderie between doormen back in the day.
So that's a situation where they'd notified you they were coming with the weapons. What about in the club and someone just blindsides you who's got a weapon? Did you come across that?
Very lucky that it didn't happen to me in a situation, although I had one or two lucky escapes. I remember working at Legends nightclub. I was a head
Warrington.
Dorm. A head doorman. No, it was in Newcastle.
I think it was a few
up and down the country, and this one in Newcastle in particular, there was a group of Asians that kicked off, and I managed to dive in and get a hold of one. And when we look back at the video footage, there was an Asian guy who had just slung a bottle, and he'd just come in and just literally missed my head, and whether he got knocked from behind or whatever, and it smashed. And I remember seeing the glass smash as I dragged his mate out. But, I mean, that would have been, you know, I probably would have been knocked out with it, because I certainly would have had a big lump on my head and a big scar for the rest of my life, but that kid had missed. A couple of guys have pulled knives on us in the past on the front
door. Did you have wands?
Pardon?
Didn't you have the ones?
No, no, we never had anything like that. No, no, no. But it was just, you know, that kind of situation would happen on a regular basis. You know, you would have, you know, people pull pneumonia. That was a big thing. Jif Lemon bottles. Yeah. You had to be careful with that. You know, someone comes up and threatens you. But
blind you, can it?
Yeah. I always felt that if anyone, you know, always be worried about the people who don't say anything. The people who tend to say, I'm going to come back and I'm going to do this and do that, tended not to come back. But it was the people who essentially would say nothing that I was always a bit more concerned about.
The pneumonia's like the young football thug thing, isn't it, really?
Yeah, of course it was, yeah, definitely. And, you know, those kind of days are returning now. You know, I've heard a few stories on the news recently where, you know, knives maybe haven't been used, but someone's been squirted with ammonia or even with acid from, like, a Jif Lemon bottle, which, you know, it's a horrendous thing to do to anybody, you know.
Do the junior bouncers have a protocol or special training to deal with people with knives or poisons? Or
that
anything?
Came later, really. I mean, obviously, the licensing came in the late 90s. The licensing was predominantly brought in because of the likes of the Sayers in Newcastle. You know, the I remember the police going on TV and saying that they were dealing with a new breed of criminal, and new laws would have to be brought in. And I think they also realised that there was a lot of doormen who were actually connected with organised crime, not just in Newcastle, but up and down the country. So they thought, if we can regulate this, then, you know, maybe that'll drive away a few of the criminals. So that's what they did. They started getting the licenses in, and that meant that a lot of people who had criminal records were driven off the doors, which of course meant that new doormen had to come in. And to be honest, you know, we lost a lot of good doormen.
Most of the doormen back in the day up here, they were all like, they're the ones selling the drugs and shit like that, you know what I mean? They're the ones.
Yeah, exactly.
But did stop the young kids from coming in and stop the violence and stop shit like that.
Yeah. That was a problem you had. You know, you'd gone from the days of like Viv Graham.
Yeah, yeah.
In Newcastle, who was running the doorman. He was like the fourth emergency service, if you like. But, you know, they were running various, you know, things through the doors. And that, you know, they had to drive that off. So the licensing coming in changed it. And that's where the training came from. So you mentioned, like, did you have training about how to disarm knives, etc.? That did come in later on. And obviously with the licensing, it also helped people with drugs and stuff like that, how to notice, you know, someone who's off the face on drugs or someone dealing drugs, etc. And the downside of it was showing you how to restrain people and take them out of clubs. And it, you know, anyone watching the videos, which are still on today, you know, you just wouldn't restrain somebody like that in a nightclub. It would never happen. You know, you don't get that opportunity or time to go, excuse me, can I just walk you out the club? It's like, it just doesn't work that.
The chicken wing you.
Yeah, exactly. Not when someone's coming, at you with a bottle or something, or, you know, swilled you or whatever. It just, you know, you don't have time to be polite to people in that situation.
So if someone's coming at you with a knife, are you going to grab the person, grab the arm, or get out the way, sidestep?
What I used to do essentially was go towards them. You know, I never used to walk away. Yeah, yeah. You know, obviously talking somebody down, you know, always make sure your hands were up. Do you know what I mean? And they're focused on what you're doing. And, you know, never go in an offensive way, but try to go towards them, hands up, and almost show that, yeah, you know, you're not a threat. But, you know, it's look at the draw, really. I think if your time's up, your time's up. You know, I was just particularly lucky in the situations that I was involved with, you know. Towards the latter part of doing my job, you know, people were threatening to shoot us and various things. And, you know, did they come back and do it? No. Were those people capable of doing it? Yes, they probably were. But, you know, it's just part and parcel of doing the door job. It's what you get paid for. You're paid to look after the licensed premises. And if somebody is acting up in your licensed premises, then they have to go. It's your job to do that. But what I found was they were making our jobs more and more impossible. Big door firms were coming into Newcastle. They were really starting to, you know, drive the price down. So you had situations where doorman firms were cutting doorman firms' own throats. And I was lucky. I was still, when I wrapped in on the doors, I was still on 18 to 20 quid an hour as a head doorman. But most people in Newcastle were down to £10 an hour for doing exactly the same job I'd started doing 18 years ago. And it just made it, for me, it made it more difficult. They were also cutting the size of the door teams down. So I was working at Tiger Tiger in Newcastle, where our capacity on a Saturday night was 2,000. Now, it should be, by law, one doorman per 100 people in your venue.
Yeah.
So we should have had 20 doormen on a Saturday night. We were working on a Saturday with four doormen on the front door and two inside. six people to look after 2,000 people. Absolutely crazy. So, you know, it was no the wonder if there was a fight inside that maybe somebody was going to get hurt.
Yeah.
A member of the general public was going to get hurt because, you know, because of the major companies cost cutting. And the first thing they cut is the security, because that's the most expensive thing on a night time, you know. And they were doing it at the failure of the general public. But this is what happened with places, you know, sadly.
You've described a very professional operation, but when you're surrounded by violence, it's hard to calculate what's going to happen next, and things do go wrong. What was the most messed up situation you ever experienced?
Probably one or two, but one of the ones I always remember is a one which just didn't look as if it was going to kick off. It was a kid on the front door. He'd been thrown out of Tiger again in Newcastle for being drunk and being a pest to women. He's a Scottish lad. He seemed like he was on his own. Obviously, you never think this person's on their own. You think he could be with his mate. He must have got lost. You know, you just don't know. But he was on the door and he wouldn't go away. And, you know, you can't push people. The cameras are there. And in the old days, this guy would have just got a right hander. He would have been levelled and that would have been the end of that. But with the new era and doors, you've got the camera, and all you can do is move them away. You know, you get the manager to go and speak to the police who are standing over there. Can you ask him to move away from the door? They'd come over, he'd move them away, and he just kept coming back, this kid. He was a pest. And anyway, he pushed the wrong buttons of this guy who was working on the door with me. We used to swap round. I was the head doorman, there was a deputy head doorman, and we used to swap the other lads around every half hour. And this other kid just comes, and he'd obviously had a bad day. And he just wouldn't take anything from this Scottish lad. And he just bang like that. And the kid went one way, his tooth went the other. He hit the floor, his head hit the concrete. And I was like, oh my God, he's killed the kid. Yeah, that's what it looked like. But that wasn't my biggest issue, because as soon as he did that, out of nowhere, it was like a scene out of, you know, one of these big like army films, you know, where there was just a herd of jocks appeared from nowhere. We were surrounded by, I would say, around about 60 to 70 Scottish lads.
Like the Warriors and the Wanderers.
It was like Braveheart.
So we
ended up looking at, you know, I'm more concerned about the kid, but the kids were all outside. They must have all just come out, gone to the burger van and been milling around. They all suddenly were on the door. And just with a click of quick as a flash, I just acted straight away and I just pulled the door shut. But I have never seen a being massive people that annoyed.
That quick.
Yeah, exactly. So the police came. The doorman was spoken to. He had to give his account of events. The camera backed up what he'd said. The kid had actually moved towards him, and it looked as if he'd pushed him. So the doorman defended himself. But it was, you know, that was one of those crazy situations. We'd had another one at Sam Jack's, exactly the same, where we used to work on the front door. There was an upstairs to that, though, and another group of Scottish stag do lads just basically kicking off on the stairs, and there was about 30 lads and about six doormen who just had this massive Barney on the stairs. It was, but it's those kind of things. It gets the adrenaline going. There's a bit of camaraderie between you, and once you get people out the venue and no one's being hurt, none of the members of public are being hurt, you know, you couldn't give a monkey's about the person who's maybe caused the trouble. If they've had a little slap, then fair enough. But it was, that was what it was like. Newcastle was a little bit like the Wild West. But, it, you know, from my perspective, it was, you know, we did our job. And I'm glad to say in 18 years, I only hit two people in 18 years.
That's good, isn't it? Very good.
What about the worst injury you sustained?
None whatsoever.
None?
At all.
Jesus.
None at all. And that's quite a remarkable stat for somebody who stood on the front door, probably 16 of those 18 years.
Yeah.
You know, split a fair few pairs of pants, writhing around on the floor and dragging people out, and then having to work on the door with me backside hanging out. But other than that, no, look, very lucky. I think it's because I didn't put myself into those situations. You know, I mean, there was many a time, as I say, where people, you know, maybe came up and had a go or threatened me or, you know, wanted to do something. But I'm just very lucky to say that in those situations, you know, that we either managed to defuse the situation or their friends took them away or police would come down and arrest them. You know, it just depends. On, you know, if you, I always feel if you're looking for trouble, you'll get it, and I never looked for trouble.
In prison, there's like an energy on the yard that changes before violence kicks off. Do you have a sense for that in the club, so you could go in and diffuse a situation before it actually even happened?
On the numerous occasions that I worked inside places, 100%, you can definitely see it. I was always, you know, on nights out with me wife especially, she would always get a bit frustrated that, you know, if we go out, I was always looking around. You know,
you got to be aware of it, haven't you?
I don't do it as much nowadays, but, yeah. I, you know, it becomes an instinct. So if I'm out, you know, I might be listening to you, but I'll be looking over your shoulder, or I'll be looking, and as soon as I see somebody walk in, you can sense it, you know. And especially if there's a well-known criminal walks in, you know, into the venue, you know, they might not be barred from the venue, but you know that they're a potential troublemaker, or there could be a potential flashpoint with them. So you just start to look at them and make sure that there's, you know, nothing going on, nobody around them that could cause any issues. And yeah, I prided myself in the fact that if I did work in a venue and work in that kind of situation, that I was always across to maybe nip it in the bud, shall we say, before it actually kicked off. But yeah, you can notice that kind of thing happening on a regular basis. A good doorman should see that automatically and should get across before the trouble kicks off.
It's a good thing to know, though, isn't it, having that sense? If you didn't have that sense, you could be in trouble, couldn't you?
Oh, 100%. And, I mean, you could be in trouble, but so could everybody else in the venue.
Yeah.
That's the problem, you know. One little fight can escalate as well, and it can become like the Wild West, especially in a place like Newcastle. Liverpool's the same. You go out for a night out, one little fight, you know, turns into, you know, other people having skirmishes and bottles, and it's always somebody sadly innocent who gets a glass in their face or whatever, you know what I mean, and ends up in the middle of it as collateral damage, and it's not a nice place to be.
I've seen it in Liverpool where the doorman have took out, or they've even had to guide the woman out or whatever, and they've pushed her away, and that's it. Guys are kicking off, and before you know it, they're all just crowding the doorman.
Yeah,
and other doormen from other places are coming to help out and all that. But it's just so quick, it can happen like that.
Yeah, and that's the worst thing about it.
Because, and the woman deserves to be, she wasn't like hit or anything, but she kept on hitting the doorman with her handbag, smacking him across the face. So all went like that, he just pushed her out the door. And next minute this lad come, and then these other lads come, and they jumped on him, and then it just went off. It was on YouTube.
Domestics are the worst as well. I mean, I've seen many a domestic in Newcastle where maybe a lad and a lass have been having a fight, a big argument, and maybe you've seen the lad slap the woman in the face and she's punched him. So then you'll get an innocent guy with his kebab walking past thinking, whoa, 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 you cannot hit that lass.
And then he gets involved.
And then the next thing you know, the man in the white for hitting him, he's dropped his kebab on the ground and he's getting a stiletto heel in the back of his head because
I've
he shouldn't
have done to me.
And that's, you know, that's a regular occurrence on a night out. I think for Newcastle, for me, it's got that history now of being like the party capital. You know, it's like fifth party capital in the world, which is a great reputation to have. And subsequently, the reality programmes like Geordie Shore have given it that extra bit of publicity. Come to Newcastle, the girls all go out with no clothes on, and, you know, it's a great night out, and, you know, you're guaranteed to get laid in Newcastle. And it's probably done our city a great disservice because it's so much more than that, you know.
Hasn't done the females much good, has it, that Geordie Shore? No, really, you know what I mean?
Definitely not. It's, you know, our city's a lot more than that. It's a place to be proud of. It's got fantastic heritage, it's got great architecture, and it's you know, it's a place where, you know, people should walk around and feel proud to be part of it, you know. It's a fantastic place, and it's a different city to the one that I remember, you know, maybe 25 years ago when it was like Liverpool, the old docks were rotting away.
Liverpool's changed, hasn't it?
The shipbuilding's gone, you know, the coal mining's gone, you know, what's left. But Newcastle, as Liverpool has, as we were driving through to come here today, you know, it's gone through a dramatic change, yeah, and a change for the better.
So Stephen Sayers told us the story of bouncers who picked on his lad. They didn't know who he was. Did you have an understanding with certain gangsters?
Yeah, 100%, because I always felt that it was very important. I mean, my very first night on the doors in Newcastle, I came across Stephen's stepsister, who's sadly passed away a couple of years ago, Joanne Sayers. And she came up to the door on the very first night that I worked on the door, and she started mouthing off. She couldn't get in. Gary the doorman had knocked her back. And I watched this woman and I'm thinking, who on earth's that, you know? So, of course, when she left, he's going, oh, he says, what you need to know is there's a few families in Newcastle and, you know, that's one of them, the Sayers family. He says, there's the Tams and there's the Harrisons and there's the Conroys. And he says, all of these families, he says, they've all got offspring, and he says they all think they're this and they all think they're that, and they'll all want to come in. And he says, it's up to you, you know, if you get on with these people, and it's entirely up to you. But, you know, he says, she's not getting in tonight, and that's the kind of abuse you'll get, he says, on a regular basis. So he taught us a valuable lesson from the first moment. But yeah, I always played it fair. You know, I didn't know any of them, I wasn't associated with any of them.
Was she just too drunk to get in with?
Yeah, Yeah, yeah. But he just didn't want her in, full stop, yeah. You know. It's like that old adage with doormen. Back in the day when I was starting the door, it used to be you couldn't get in if you had a bald head, or you couldn't get in if you had white socks.
Yeah.
Bald head meant you were a troublemaker. I'm still don't know what having white socks on had to do with being a troublemaker, but you couldn't go in with white socks. That was the bizarre thing. And it just became like an excuse. So you got given those kind of excuses from the start. But I think anything to do with notorious families always... You know, it could always lead to trouble. If you had like one family coming in who was having a rick with the other family, then you would have trouble in the bar. So Gary's way of doing the front door was, don't let any of them in and I won't have any trouble. I'll have the trouble on the front door. I can cope with that. I don't want any trouble inside. And that was the way he did it. I used to do it in a different way. I used to let people in. Some people might say, well, that's a soft way of doing it. But I always felt that if I had the trust of those people and they could come in and behave, then... there wouldn't be any issues moving forward. I would have the respect of them. But at the same time, if they kicked off and I had to get them out, then I would bar them. But I wouldn't bar people indefinitely like some doorman did. I would say, right, look, come back next week. I'll have a word with my manager and we'll see where we'll go from there. Depending on what they'd done. If they, you know, if one of the lads had grabbed some lass's backside or, you know, threw a drink on somebody, then, you know, it's not a massive crime. It's something which you've done because you're drunk and... But if they'd, you know, started a fight, you know, punched somebody, knocked somebody out in the toilets, whatever, then...
That's someone, so whatever, serious.
You know, obviously that's a lot more serious and, you know, we can't have you doing that because you're taking the mick out of me. That was the way I dealt with things. And I think just as the families changed in Newcastle and as various, you know, various things happened, then, you know, obviously some families become more notorious and you side with them, I suppose, in a lot of ways. And with the Sears family, there's that many of them. I got to know the brothers. I got to know the cousins, but I always found them to be really friendly and you know, affable and people who I could communicate with. And ultimately, when, you know, the lads got out of prison, when Stephen got out of prison, John got out of prison, Michael got out of prison, you know, I got to meet them all. And if you're in their line of work, you know, if you're in their line of work back in the noughties, then you crossed them, you know, God knows what would happen to you. But from my point of view, I was a doorman working in Newcastle City Centre. I got to know these people. I had a relationship already with well-known criminals in the craze. And, you know, for me, it was just, you know, water off a duck's back speaking to these people. It wasn't something, again, which unnerved me.
Were there certain type of people that you despised dealing with that you knew this is going to be a situation like?
I think for me, there's always an issue when you're dealing with groups. You know, the football hooligan side of things, I always found, you know, a concern because, you know, they wouldn't come in and deal with you on your own. Mm. But when there's in a big group, then it's very difficult to manage a big group. There were certain occasions where I would be working on the door, maybe it's just with one other person. Sometimes it was a female because female door supervisors had started to come in. And if you end up with, you know, 10, 15, 20 football fans or hooligans in your bar, then you've got to deal with that with a female door supervisor. And I'm not saying that they can't do the same job as a man, but what I'm saying is, you know, sometimes we find it pretty difficult, you know, physically to deal with it. And even if it was two guys, you'd find it difficult to deal with a football hooligan. So those situations were hair raising, even for somebody with no hair. You had that situation, which, you know, you had to address. But, you know, we always got through it. We always managed to defuse a situation. I always felt going to the leader or the main person was the right thing to do. You know, you take that person out of the equation, the rest follow. Because they are, you know, a lot of these groups are like sheep, you know, that follow the leader. And that was the way that I worked it. It was just... You know, essentially speaking to people and dealing with people that way. Other situations, I think, really just dealing with women, drunk women, was always a nightmare because there's no reasoning in them. There's no reasoning with a woman, and of course you can't really put your hands on a woman. You know, and as much as you would like to, because sometimes they're worse than the fellas. You know, you would always have to talk to a woman, and they know that they could push you and push you and push you. You know, so you had a few situations, and
you can guide them out, though, can't you?
You can, but even then, even more so now. I can imagine for poor doorman now. I mean, I came off the doors in 2010, but it's you know, sexual harassment. He touched us. You can imagine there'd be some kind of claim going in now if a doorman did that. But I had some really weird situations. Two really good stories, and they're funny stories. One's about a man and one's about a woman. There was one man who essentially, in Legends again, was the first person to have toilet attendants in the toilets. And they used to have a white shirt on, dicky bow tie, and they'd have all the chewing gum and the lollipops and the aftershaves.
Oh, shave, give them a quid. Yeah.
And this kid was like the very first toilet attendant in Newcastle. Great lad. And he had a radio, so if there's any, you know, shenanigans going on in the toilets, he would call us down. So I got the call, Steve, can you come downstairs? I think there's somebody taking drugs in the toilets. So anyway, you know, run down the stairs, me and a couple of the lads, bang on the door in the cubicle, no answer. Bang on the door, you know, no answer. And unfortunately, in Legends, you couldn't look over the top of the toilets because normally you'd be able to go into the toilet next door, stand on the seat, look over and see what's going on. You know,
under?
Couldn't do that either. It was a proper sealed door. And you couldn't look over the top. So there's no other way than to kick the door in. The kid could be, you know, it doesn't sound like he's doing anything. He's not wrapping anything up and coming back out. But there's nothing, the silence. You know, has he collapsed? Has he, you know, what?
Don't give away when two or three walk out, though, wouldn't it?
Oh, exactly. Yeah. So anyway, so we booted the door through and the kid's in the toilet, but he's kneeling down on the ground. His pants are down and he's facing the toilet. And I'm thinking, what on earth is he doing, you know? So anyway, as we kick the door in, he turns round like that, like looking startled, and he's got his hand out and he's got these little brown balls in his hand, you know? So like the lads all go, whoa, like that, and step back. I've never seen as many doormen like step back as quickly, and I'm at the front. In his other hand, he's got his cock, and he's basically masturbating over his own shit, which he's made into little planets in his hand. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, it's like Close Encounters of the Third Kind, you know? It was like, it was just ridiculous. I've never seen anything like it. So that was one bizarre story. The other one was this woman, a Tiger, who she came out. And I mean, it was hectic. It was a Saturday night, you know, queues out the door, people coming in, people getting thrown out, you know, chaos in the door. And this woman comes out, like, you know, poshest woman you could ever think of. And she goes, excuse me. She says, could I get a half glass? And I said, you know, you look at people and you think, a half glass? You've just come out of the bar. Why are you asking the doorman on the front door, can I have a half glass? And I went, if you go back inside, Pet, I says, you know, just ask behind the bar, you know. Oh, yes, I never thought of that. So anyway, she goes back in. 5 minutes later, you know, she comes back out. We'd forgotten all about her. She comes back out and she says, do you mind if I go around that side of that door? And I went, yeah, no problem. So she goes around the side of the door where I'm standing on the right-hand side, and it's a door with like a big glass door. You can see straight through it. And she proceeds to unbutton her blouse, and then she takes her bra up, and then she gets her breast out, and she gets the glass, and she starts squeezing the milk out of her breast into this half glass. And I'm like looking at me, the other doorman, and I'm going, you know, like that. And he's looking at me, and she fills up about half a pint of milk, and she comes back around and she goes, thanks very much, swills it over the front door and goes back in and takes the glass inside. And I'm thinking, my God, what on earth are you dealing with? This is the thing with the general public. You're dealing with, you're not only dealing with violence, you're just dealing with the warped and the weird sense of, you know, what people will do on a night out. You know,
I've had Dorman come in the toilet with me once. It was when we went for that meal and that guy had got stabbed. It was me, you and Sean. And we'd gone for the meal.
In Arizona?
No, yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. We went for an Indian. And that guy got stabbed. Can't you remember?
I can't remember what happened then.
Well, basically, we were all in a big square somewhere.
Yeah.
And I went off to use the toilet. I'm sitting there, I'm having a fucking shit, aren't I? And I'm fucking, I have to finish shitting. And I look, there's no bastard toilet paper. And I'm thinking, oh, fucking hell. What do I do? So I thought, I know. So I take my shoes off and I take my socks off. So as I'm doing this, the fucking door comes flying in and it's the doorman. I said, what the fuck's up? He said, oh, someone's just complained saying that you're taking your socks off, you're getting drugs out. I said, no, I've fucking got no bog roll, have I? I'm just using it as bog roll, you know what I mean?
Did he give you some bog roll?
Did he fuck? No, I had to use my sock.
An arsehole?
We used to work at a place called Planet Earth, used to be the Dolce Vita in Newcastle, and I worked with a guy called Raoul Moat, who obviously went on to be quite notorious for, you know, for killing a guy in Gateshead, shooting a police officer and then going on a run for six ideas in Newcastle, eventually turned up in Rothbury, and then was shot dead by the police. Hell of a story, but you know, Raoul was a really nice guy, a genuine, down-to-earth Geordie lad, a doorman, somebody who, you know, was obviously wound up to the extent where he had to carry out such a horrendous, you know, horrendous crime and end up in such a horrendous set of events. But before that, he was just a really nice lad. And we used to work on a Sunday night. The upstairs part of the bar was called Bonkers. And what they used to do for the first 2 hours on a Sunday was they used to do one-pence shots. And he used to get trebles for 3 pence. Wow. And the mixer was 150. So it was just ridiculous. So you can imagine everyone used to come there. The girls used to come there. But because there was only the two of us on the door and one inside, we all had to swap round and take turns to work inside. And you can imagine the states that the girls got themselves into. And of course, this one particular night, it was my turn to work inside for the half hour stretch. And I just remember this girl saying, "My mate's collapsed in the toilets." And I was going, "Oh, no." So I went in, and of course, there was this woman. She must have been about 20 stone. She had a knickers again round her ankles. She'd basically been for a crap, and she'd obviously made herself sick by her own smell. So she got up mid-crap, started kneeling down, and was sick. So she'd been sick down her front. She'd got crap coming out of her arse.
Oh, my God.
And she's 20 stone. And of course, I'm the one who's having to like lift her out. And, well, can you clean her up, girls? And, oh, just an absolute nightmare, you know. So there was, so obviously, Raoul was laughing at us on that particular night. But we had a laugh at his expense a couple of weeks later. We were manager, Malcolm, and the head doorman, and the guy who got with the job in there, Mickey Armstrong. He used to love pranking people, and what we used to have was, you had the front door, and then you used to walk about 200 yards and up the side street. There's a little alleyway. The alleyway's still there. The club's long gone now, but the little alleyway used to have a fire exit at the top. So Mickey came to us one night. He says, "We're going to get Raoul tonight." He says, "Will you be in on it?" And I went, "Yeah, no problem." So what he did was, he went and he said, "What I'll do is I'll radio down and say that there's a girl being put out at the top fire exit, and can somebody go and see her?" So he says, that's all you need to know. And I went, "Right, okay, no problem." So anyway, we sent Mark Barrett inside. He went upstairs to do his thing. Me and Raoul are on the front door. Radio goes, "Come on, just go and have a look around the corner. There's a lass collapsed at the top fire exit. We can see her on the camera." So off Raoul goes. And this is before mobile phones or anything. So off I go and I had a look up the alleyways. Raoul goes running up. And sure enough, there's a girl slumped up, like lying there. And just as Raoul gets to her to ask if she's all right, you just hear whoosh. And basically what they've done is they've filled this big bucket full of water and ice. And Malcolm and Mickey were upstairs at the top office, and they just poured this water, and you just see this gush of water, and it's like one of those Wile E. Coyote films. Yeah. Raoul just looked up like that, covered in water, absolutely soaked a bit. And, you know, I had to work the whole night or go home and get changed. But, you know, it was the funniest side of doing the door. You know, I had a lot of laughs. And again, it comes down to camaraderie, you know, being in that kind of situation. You can have a, you know, you've got to kill a lot of times. It's not all violence and running around like being a superhero. It's a lot of it standing bored stiff and making your own entertainment. It's, you know, and that's what we did.
So the black market in drugs gets bigger every single year. And it's so big now it corrupts every profession it comes into contact with, some people. You saw the doorman wars in Manchester over the Hacienda and the clubs there. How did you navigate that?
Drugs were a big thing in Newcastle. I mean, I remember going on radio Newcastle and I think I'd said 70% of the people going into Newcastle on a night out are probably taking cocaine or they're taking ecstasy. And I remember the people from the breweries going mad at us when they saw us the following weekend. They're going, "How dare you say that? And why would you say that? You know, it's not true." And I was going, "I'm standing here watching it. You know, I'm seeing what's going on. You know, I'm on the front line. You're not. You're sitting in your office counting your money. I can see what's going on." I said, "I'm only, you know, I was asked for my opinion and I gave my opinion." Newcastle was different. You know, it obviously went on, but, you know, I never got dragged into that. I never got compromised. I never got asked to do something that, you know, would put my job at threat. And I was always pretty good at spotting, you know, the people coming in, the dealers, etc. So most of the places that I worked at where I was head doorman, then there was never an issue. The places where I worked at where I wasn't head doorman, there was issues. And, you know, there was a well-publicised drugs raid at Sea Nightclub. I was working at Sea at the time. I was head doorman at Chase on the Quayside, which was run by the same company. So I didn't see the drugs raid. I was working on the front door at Chase, and then I would go from there at 11 o'clock once I cleared that bar out to go and do my shift at the sea. And I got there and it was surrounded by police. The place had, we got told there was no shift that night. But there'd been an undercover surveillance operation going on from a derelict bar across the road. The head doorman and his deputy head doorman had been arrested. Mm. The manager was arrested. And subsequently, you know, there was you know, charges pressed and things happened. But, you know, from my position, I was never involved in anything like that. So, you know, being involved at a bar where your reputation was tarnished wasn't a pleasant thing to go through. But, you know, the venue shut down, was reopened under a different name. We all got moved to different places to continue our work. But yeah, it was a bit of a shock to go through that. But yeah, it's rife, you know, in every city, and, you know, it continues to grow the drugs market. And, you know, as long as there's a demand, it will always grow.
I was thinking that, you know, I know a lot of people, what I call as straight heads, who just work. But come Friday or Saturday, when they're going out with the lads, it's guaranteed the shit shower shaved, they've gone out and got themselves a bag of coke. So they can drink more, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like more of a common thing to do nowadays.
Well, I mean, back in the day, it was, you know, rave parties was all about taking ecstasy tablets.
Yeah.
And I mean, I hate to say it, but ecstasy probably back in the day was a lot safer than it is now.
It's a lot better too, wasn't it?
And you've got, you know, obviously then it was speed. And the reason people took speed is because, you know, they wanted to stay up later. Do you know what I mean? A lot of people would take speed to keep going and so they could enjoy the night out, etc. But there was less trouble in those days. I mean, I remember, you know, I was part of the, you know, the rave scene, and, you know, there was less trouble, you know. Dorman would go to these raves afterwards. You know, Newcastle had clubs like the After Dark in South Shields, the Monkey in Sunderland. Those kind of places were where you would find bar staff and doorman going after they'd finished work, you know, and everyone would be hugging each other, kissing each other, and there was never any trouble, you know. It was like a new thing, but it was a, you know, football hooligans, you know. There was, you know, you'd find Newcastle and Sunderland fans together.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Crazy, you know.
When not on Saturday afternoon, but you would see them like...
Exactly, yeah. You know, they'd want to beat the crap out of each other on a Saturday afternoon on the terraces, and then kiss each other and hug each other and dance to their favourite tune on a Saturday night at a chosen venue, which was mad, you know. But, like, you know, as time's gone on and dealers and, you know, the people higher up the chain have got greedier and started to cut it with various stuff, then it obviously changed things, you know, probably for the worse, you know. And I think there was big changes, the death of Leah Betts especially, you know, in the Essex Boys era.
Yeah.
That changed things massively, especially with being the daughter of a police, you know, high-ranking police officer. I think that changed things massively for everybody in the UK.
Do you think if she wasn't the daughter of a high-ranking police officer, it would have made as much publicity as it did?
No, definitely not. I mean, that case is you know, it's huge, isn't it? And I mean, it's become a franchise now with the rise of the Foot Soldier films. I mean, you know, I was in the third one myself, you know, so I've been part of that franchise. But it's, I think, you know, definitely think that had an effect. I've heard the stories and the rumours, you know, a lot of people saying obviously the wrong people have been locked up for that crime, and that, you know, basically some people even suggesting that the police were involved in potentially, you know, bumping off the Essex Boys, A, because they were causing so much trouble in their force area, but also because it was the daughter of, you know, a high-ranking police officer. But we'll never know the truth. You know, as far as the justice system's concerned, they've got the right people in there serving their time, and, you know, that's that. The case is closed. But, you know, we'll never really know the truth about that. But yeah, the whole drug scene and the drugs industry is, you know, it's still big business in the UK, whether the government and whether the police like it or not. And a lot of people would suggest that they might even be getting a little backhander off the back of the drugs industry as well anyway, you know.
Have you read the Devil's book, Frenchy's book?
Yeah.
So he's describing these, like, one bouncer firm tries to wipe out another bouncer firm. They just all show up with weapons, and then Frenchy's shooting off his gun. And, you know, that's how they try and take over the door. Mm. When you were running stuff, did anyone try that on you?
No, you know, because most of the time I was working for door firms, but it wasn't like that. There was probably three main door firms in Newcastle. You know, for me, I was always more of a free spirit and would go to work with different people. So I worked for Ultimate Leisure, which was great. Then I worked for Jeff Orton. I worked for Mickey Armstrong. And those three were the main, for me, the main, you know, the main companies that you could work for. It was always Paul Lister. I'd never worked with Paul. Always got a great deal of respect for him, former professional boxer.
Didn't Finn have his own
firm? Yeah, but it was prior to me really coming under the doors. And that was before the licensing came in as well.
Was it?
But he was, you know, he was, you know, he had his own lads, but that was earlier than me starting the doors.
It was like there's a movie called Shooters. That's like
great film,
excellent film in it. But that was like way back, like early 80s, isn't it? Really?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the story behind that, of course, was you know, I put that on my YouTube channel many years ago. That's a kind of angle we want to go down with Stephen Sears' film.
I love that movie.
It's one of my favourites. Real gangsters playing real gangsters. Yeah. Real drug dealers playing real drug dealers. Real prostitutes playing real prostitutes.
I mean, real funny side. Really good. Two top movies I really like. I like that. And I like, from a funny side of it, I like The Business.
Yeah, The Business is good. It is good, but
I just like the Al Sergio. I like the Al that like sort of dress.
Goodfellas is my favorite gangster film of all time.
Goodfellas.
The Godfather's always great, but I do like Goodfellas because obviously, you know, with my friend Neil Jackson, I got to bring Henry Hill to the UK and be with him for a week, so we got to know him really, really well. But I think from an English point of view, it's got to be Villain with Richard Burton.
Oh, okay.
That's fantastic. Based roughly on Ronnie Cray, of course. The Crays, the 1990 version with, you know, Ray Burdus, obviously, and Dominic Anciano, who did that, and the Kemp brothers playing the Crays. Although not, you know, correct as far as the storyline's concerned, it's as close as you're going to get. I think that's pretty good.
What do you think about Snatch or Lock, Stock and Two Smoking?
I enjoyed them, but I've got to be honest, I've never watched them. Watched them first time round, but never like revisited them. I'm more like
you
the
couldn't
young
compare
Good Friday.
Them to the Goodfellas or anything like that.
Nah,
any movie was sort of narrated where like there's a guy speaking over it, talking about it.
Yeah,
it's a good movie, I think. You know what I mean?
100%. I mean, I get caught. I like to watch a lot of these, like a lot of these series. I'm banging to the Netflix stuff.
Yeah,
I like Gomorrah. Anyone who's, you know, if you watch Gomorrah,
Saviano.
Fantastic. Yeah. That's really, really good. It's subtitled.
Yeah,
but, it's well worth a watch. Obviously, a big Sopranos fan as well. So over the years, got to watch, you know, a lot of these things, and I think I've picked a lot of influences up because as an actor now, you know, wanting to play those parts and not being typecast. The more that you watch and the more you pick up from either the real villains who I know or from watching other people's way of playing a villain, it's always quite handy. You know?
A really good movie too, I forgot what it's called. It starts off these kids growing up and they steal a hot dog cart and they're pushing it down and the hot dog cart goes down a subway and kills a woman. And they end up going to court or to like a remand school. And they end up getting buggered and that by the people from there.
Mm.
But they end up growing up as policemen and getting the guy back.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some good stuff out there. It's just, it's going out and finding it, really, isn't it? It's getting out and finding it.
All right, so moving on to the major underworld figures that you've written about then. Let's start with Charles Bronson.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about with him?
Well, he was Charles Bronson when I first met him. He's Charles Salvador now. It's 20 years ago.
I've got a Bronson video up recently. Americans are asking me, is this the US actor?
No.
let's explain who he is.
Yeah, he was Michael Peterson when he was first given his jail sentence. He's not a prolific criminal. He's not somebody who's gone out on the street and carried out 30 robberies or 20 murders. He's essentially someone who is just a man of immense physical strength. You know,
he was only doing 6 months or so crazy though, wasn't he?
He carried out a very small robbery, which he got a sentence for. But sadly, because of his behaviour in jail, he became the most notorious prisoner in prison. His feat of strength is akin to somebody like Frank Mitchell, who obviously died in the 60s. Somebody who could probably pick up you and I, you know, with his hands and lift us above his head. He's got that kind of sheer strength. But he just became notorious for somebody who liked to row in prison and, you know, assaulting prison officers.
Taking
inmates hostage. You know, he took a load of Iraqi hostages once, Iraqi terrorists hostage in a cell once and got them to tickle his feet with a feather.
I think that's hilarious, Michelle.
His stories are synonymous, but what he did in jail, of course, is he changed his name from Michael Peterson, then Charles Bronson, after the well-known American actor. But when he was in prison, he started to find a little bit of therapy from art. So he started started off by, you know, drawing, you know, little pictures of himself and the predicaments that he'd been in.
Yeah.
And that's just really, you know, that's really blossomed in prison. So despite all his, you know, all the issues that he's had, he started to draw art. My first connection with him was really through Joe Pyle Sr. in London. Joe rang me up one day and said that Charlie was a good friend of his. Could I make an inquiry with his manager at the time, Steve Richards? Charlie'd fell out with him. He said that Steve Richards had a lot of the stuff that belonged to him, a lot of his personal belongings, etc., in a house in Gateshead, which is where I was living at the time. And would I be able to get it back for him? And that's how the relationship started. So then Charlie would write to me after I'd managed to get the stuff. Steve Richards was fine. He realised that the end of the road had come as far as managing Charlie was concerned. And he was fine with me, gave me the boxes of stuff back. And then I got that down to London to Joe Pyle. So that was it. And so the friendship started there. Charlie then asked me to look after him, to manage him after doing that kind of gig for him. I had no experience at looking after somebody who was institutionalised other than the merchandise kind of thing that I'd done with the Craze. So I said, yeah, I'll give it a go. I set up a website for him. I started creating, you know, various things for him, calendars and T-shirts, etc. But sadly, somebody who had it in for me, a lot of jealousy goes on in this world, had basically stirred a little bit of trouble up with, you know, for me with Charlie, and we fell out. He needed me more than I needed him, so it was no skin off my nose. I gave Joe Pyle the stuff back, and that was it. We moved on. But over the years, I've had the odd Christmas card, I've had the odd letter, we kept in touch.
Yeah.
And moving forward with me doing books, it just became a natural progression to say to him, look, if you ever want anything done, I'll help you out. And that's where Rod Harrison came in. Rod's been looking after Charlie's affairs for the last few years. I built up a good relationship with Rod. And, you know, when it came to actually doing a new book, me, Rod Harrison, Neil Jackson sat down and did a book called Art Attack with Charlie. And, you know, we just did a limited edition book, really nice quality. And, you know, it did really well. The book sold out. So, yeah, we keep up the relationship. But for 20 years, I'd never actually met him. I'd spoken to him on the phone, but never met him. So 2019, last year, I finally travelled down to prison to actually meet the guy who I've had dealings with for 20 years, which is a bit bizarre when you're working with somebody and then going down to meet him. So
you made sure he was all right with you, like.
Yeah. It's funny because, I walked in, he's in Woodhill in Milton Keynes. I've been in a lot of jails visiting the Sayers and the Craze over the years and other people. But to actually go into Woodhill was quite different because obviously he's in the CSC. So you're basically walking through the heart of the prison, which I'd never done before. I walked across prison yards, but not to the point of actually walking through the entire prison and seeing inmates out on their, out doing whatever they're doing.
That's
and
crazy.
Recreation.
You don't
and
usually see that side.
It's absolutely mad. And then you're walking towards the CSC, and the CSC is literally four big containers, for want of a better word, literally on top of each other. And it's a bleak, bleak place, and you're walking through more security gates, and then you just hear Charlie shouting out the window, hey, how are you? And all that, And so then you walk in, and there's maybe another one of the lads up there on that side who can see you shouting down to Rod. And then we walk in, and we're in a room, pretty much the size of this, three chairs on one side and him on the other, and that's it, and he just gave us a big hug and walked in. He asked us how Steve Richards was doing, which was his first question. But that was it. We hit it off straight away. He's the same size as me height wise, so we're on a level. But we had a good chat. The visit flew over. We had a good chat about different things that had happened in the past. And he was asking a lot about Freddie Foreman, who obviously I'm a good friend of and go down to see once a month. And he was asking us about, various projects I was doing, just really interested. But the key thing for me was that he's changed a lot. He has mellowed. He's 65 now.
I was going to say, he's still immensely strong, though.
Yeah. I mean, I went down to see him last month. Another visit, visits coming thick and fast now. I was speaking to him on the phone the other day, but he as soon as he went in, we're talking about fitness, and he went straight down on the floor and started doing these sit-ups. He banged out 50 sit-ups in the space of about a minute, just different ones. This is what you want to do, and this is how you want to do it. And he's talking to the people on the visit, and this is how you keep in trim, and we're never going to have six packs, but you want to have one big pack. And he's
I've
just
always thought of two people I'd never want to bump into in one night, and he's one of them, and Chopper Reed's the other one.
I think with Charlie, I just think it's going to be so difficult for him because the next step, of course, is to get off the unit. He needs to get off the unit to progress. Once he gets off the unit, he then has to go in and mix in, you know, prison population with other people.
Now, though,
yeah, that's going to be the hard part. I mean, I've listened to, you know, Medvic Dark and listened to a couple of his podcasts recently, and he talked about being on the unit and coming back in. You become institutionalized, and it is going to be difficult. And he is asking questions. Charlie's asking about what it's like, etc. But listen, he's got as good a chance as any. It's just how the prison authorities, you know, allow him to progress. He's got to be given the opportunity, but, you know, I think it'll be a couple of years yet before he gets that opportunity to move down. But he's certainly sticking in now and putting the best effort in to try and get to that.
He's probably the most well-known prison person you'd never know, isn't he? I mean, from up and down the country.
The media needed somebody once Reggie Cray died because, you know, the media rely heavily on having a celebrity criminal locked up. The media rely on it. So the Crays were forever in the paper. They're still now forever in the paper, forever referenced on dramas, soap operas, documentaries. Prime ministers use them as an example for people, you know, we don't want the criminals of today being like the Crays of yesteryear. You know, so the Crays are constantly referenced. And Bronson, you know, as he was, and now, you know, now Salvador is exactly the same. He's somebody that the media can constantly use. I mean, Rod has this constant battle of putting something onto a social media page and it being completely misconstrued in the media about Charlie. Something which should be a huge positive becomes a huge negative for Charlie. And that doesn't help him because being in the papers for various reasons, you know, ultimately counts against you when it comes to being, you know, moved off the unit. Or
he wants to see positive things around him, doesn't he? And if he's going to get negative, he's going to think negative, isn't he?
But for the last few years, Rod's definitely done that. He's got him in the right place. He's got him involved with the right kind of schemes. He's trash knives, not lives. You know, campaign is admirable. A lot of people are doing that and supporting Charlie. So, you know, Stephen Sayers has done it. Paul Ferris has supported him. So there's many of the former villains of a bigger stature have supported Charlie with a campaign. And, you know, as long as he's got his artwork as well, you know, he'll always progress. I mean, you know, his artwork changes hands for big money, you know, £1,500 to £3,000. Some of the artwork's passed through.
Wow.
You know, and that just shows you because Rod keeps it tight. You know, it doesn't just go out to everybody. You know, it's very, very special. And, you know, my 9-year-old daughter has been looking at his artwork recently and, you know, the attention to detail that she sees in it, you know, she's been amazed by it. So art affects everybody, you know, in different
ways. Even in this movie, it shows him doing the artwork, doesn't he? He does hold his teacher, like, hostage as well, like, but...
Yeah, just luckily he hasn't been involved in those kind of situations. And I dare say that there's been situations over the last few years where his buttons have been pushed and where he probably would have reacted differently a few years ago. But now, you know, touch wood and pray to God, he does get that opportunity to progress out of the unit at least and back onto a wing and then hopefully progresses through the, you know, progresses through the prison system.
I hope he doesn't die in there. I hope he gets out.
Yeah. I think he will get out. That's my honest gut feeling. I do think he'll get out. When he gets out, I'm not sure. You know, I think he's got a target in his mind, but, you know, let's see. He's 65 now and, you know, he should be a free man.
Does he tell you any funny stories from his recent years that you can share with us?
He's always got funny stories. I mean, I'm not going to name names, but there's one or two people who were on his visit list who he often says to us, you know, I can't understand why you would have somebody like that come in and see. He says, well, I'll let those people come in because it makes me feel sane, you know. So it's, but his life's one funny story, really, in a lot of ways. It's an interesting story, but he's, you know, he just, you know, he plays Scrabble, you know. You wouldn't imagine him sitting playing Scrabble in jail, but he has like Scrabble competitions with people inside. And he's just got a really nice personality. You know, he's a genuine guy when you get to meet him. And I think that's the difference between the monster that sometimes gets portrayed in the press. And I was so sorry for him when, you know, he met Paula, because Paula was a lovely woman. Paula Williamson, you know, obviously somebody who, you know, had a degree of success in acting, and, you know, she married him, and it was always going to be, you know, looked upon by certain people that, you know, she was just somebody in it for the fame and somebody who was marrying a long-term prisoner for, you know, just for the celebrity headlines for herself. But she was, you know, she was a genuine person, and for her to go the way that she did because of, you know, predominantly really because of online trolls, You know, it was such a sad thing to see, and you know, sad for Charlie really, because you know he had a good one there. He had a really nice woman, and I think it's a travesty that he hasn't been allowed to have his wedding photographs. You know, they wouldn't allow Paula to have them. He then put a request in, obviously, for those photographs to be buried with her, and you know, sadly, the prison authorities wouldn't allow that either. So, you know, it's
I think they could have met him halfway there, couldn't they? You know what I mean?
It's these kind of things which are done to provoke people like Charlie. Yeah. And you know, it's up to you how you handle it, and I suppose if you fly off the handle, then you're rising to what they want you to do, and ultimately you're back to square one. You know, you're not going to be released, and you know, the prison authorities can turn around and say, well, told you so, you know, he hasn't changed. So I think more credit to him for not rising to it and just allowing it to happen, and just knuckle down and try and get through your time. You know, he's coming into 45 years this year.
Wow.
You know, with the exception of that brief period when he was out. 45 years in jail and you know, over 30 years of that in solitary confinement. I mean, you know, a lot of the time behind actually a cage within a cell. It's you know, he's done well to keep his sanity, really.
Done well not to do himself in.
Yep. Yeah.
So you worked on Charlie's book, Heart Attack.
Heart Attack. Art A.
Oh, Art Attack.
Art Attack. That's the accent. Yeah, A-R-T.
What period of his life was that?
He just wanted to do a book basically about, you know, art and, you know, just covering the various people who he'd met through his period in prison. It was just, he's done similar books, but this one was just it was a bigger version and a nice collectible version, you know. And
wasn't there a show called that?
Sorry?
Wasn't there a show called that?
Might have been, yeah, on ITV, a kids' programme. Yeah. But it's got nothing to do with a kids' programme, but it's just a nice collectible book. I mean, we've done a lot of books, Neil Jackson and I, you know, on The Craze and Freddie Foreman in a similar format where we've just done limited edition books. We find that the smaller print runs, and maybe he's doing 300 copies and getting them signed by the people who we do them with can actually work better for us and them. We can charge a slightly higher price.
But the
signature's in it as well. And because it's collectible, and we get hit, you know, on numerous occasions. We did a book called The Craze from the Cradle to the Grave with a guy called Wayne Lear. At The Craze and Freddie Foreman, Read All About It, where we put newspaper clippings in.
Yeah.
Neil does a lot of the hard work. Me and Wayne Lear have got some big collections. Neil does the hard work editing the book, putting it together and placing it out. And then, you know, we send it off to our publishers and get them done. So, but yeah, we've hit a nice little niche. People like them. And you know,
but you guys give a good percentage out to, don't you?
Yeah, yeah, of course we do.
Like Watergate's, don't
Waterstones. No, I mean, no.
They're a rip-off.
Waterstones, WH Smith's are all about the same. It's all about 40%.
Yeah.
So if you think about it, people go, you make a fortune with books. If you've got a paperback, which is a tenner, which is the average cost of a paperback, and you're taking 40% off that, then you know there's £4 straight away that's going off. You've got £6 then. Then you've got the overheads of the book, and depending on what your print run is, you know, you could be talking £2.50, say, for a book if you order, say, 5,000 copies. Then you're down to £3.50. And then if there's two people working on the book, you've got to split that between them people. It's £1.75 each. It's not a massively productive and profitable industry, the book industry. However, it gets a story out there.
Yeah, yeah.
Some people have a story to tell. Other people have a message that they've got to get out there. And you know, always go back to the Sayers book because it's me, you know, it's the best-selling book we did. But, you know, the Sayers family were literally provoked into, you know, coming out and saying something by Paddy Conroy. You know, Paddy Conroy was never really a rival. In fact, he was, you know, a friend of the family at one point. But he just, he took an opportunity to go on national television and call the Sayers family police informers and grasses.
Be a snake in the grass.
And unfortunately for him, you know, he came up against, you know, somebody in Stephen Sayers who thought, well, actually, I'm going to put the record straight here, because an unwritten lie or an unspoken lie becomes a truth.
Yeah.
And that provoked Stephen into actually thinking, well, I better put my side of the story out here. And I'd approached Stephen a couple of years earlier and asked him to do the book, and he went, no way, we'll never do anything like that. But, you know, because of the McIntyre documentary with Paddy Conroy, that was what, you know, that was basically what stung the hornet. You know, you poke the hornet's nest.
You've got to have your saying. Everyone knows the true story, you want to know him. But people who don't know him, you throw enough mud sticks.
And that was it. I mean, for me, you know, it was a delight to hear Stephen say he wanted to do the book.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, he had his reasons for doing it. And I could understand that. And I'm not taking sides in the situation. I'm just somebody who's there to help Stephen convey the message through the book, which is what we've done with other books, you know. But Stephen wanted to get the message across. And what we found with Stephen is over the last 3 years, he's become media savvy. He understands how it works. And, you know, I think that's an important thing. Whereas in the past, there's always been this deafening silence from anyone on Tyneside.
Yeah.
Nobody on Tyneside would ever speak. The Geordie Mafia was a thing of myth and nobody really understood it. But, you know, over the course of the last few years, again, working with Neil Jackson, we've gone out and we've interviewed various figures, you know, whether it's Dennis Stafford and Michael Avaglio about the one-armed bandit murder, or whether it's John Mario Cummins, who's, you know, Cunningham, who's now dead, sadly, you know, or Machine Gun Kelly, or Kenny Pander Anderson. We've met and interviewed all of these people over the last few years, and we've opened up people's eyes to actually, there was an underworld in Newcastle, and this is what it's all about, you know. And it's been fascinating for people. And for me, yes, we can make some money out of it, but it's also social history. It's something which is just as important as, you know, the Stevenson Rocket or Hadrian's Wall in our part of the world, because it's something that people have ultimately they've grown up with, but maybe have been completely unaware of, you know. And, and the villain's history is just as important.
I never heard there's so many villains, what you just mentioned then.
Mm-hmm.
I always, doing Simon Atkinson, I always knew Viv Graham, the young lad what got killed.
Lee Duffy, yeah.
Lee Duffy. And the big guy.
Brian Cockerill, yeah. Yeah, I think the hard men stories are obviously things that are going to circulate around prisons, you know. People who can handle themselves and who can knock themselves out. And obviously people who've hit an untimely end, you know. The Lee Duffy story's renowned, you know, in Middlesbrough, which is obviously, like, you know, it's an hour's drive from Newcastle, but he was very good friends with the Sayers. He used to come and socialise with Stephen and Michael in particular. And of course, Viv Graham, who Stephen obviously served time with for the Hobos nightclub assault on Stu Watson, the doorman, you know, which again is, you know, it's a piece of gangland history in Tyneside. But, you know, Viv obviously met an untimely end. He was shot dead. Lee Duffy was stabbed to death. So those people will always be renowned. Brian Cockerill, of course, is the, you know, the person who essentially...
Resurrection,
yeah. And he's a lovely guy. He is a lovely guy. I mean, he went on, of course, on the McIntyre documentary as well.
Yeah.
And he had national recognition on there. And, you know, but he's found God now. He's you know, he's campaigning against, you know, knife crime, which is great. He's going into schools. And him and Stephen Sayers are now going to do their first two stage shows in April together.
That'd be brilliant.
I'm going to interview the two of them. And looking forward to doing those two nights. One in Blythe, one in Bishop Auckland, sorry, and one in Newcastle. So,
you mentioned social history then. How much do you think the Charles Bronson movie distorted social history?
It was very like A Clockwork Orange. That's what the Bronson film was like. I think with films, you're always going to struggle to please everybody. Career films will always be... I'll always be critical of them because I would say that I'm an expert on the Craze side of things. I've visited Reggie for 10 years, visited Ron for 5, and obviously have a big collection on them, and, you know, read every book and contributed to numerous television programs over the years about the Craze. So for me, Bronson is similar. You know, it's one film. Tom Hardy got it was Tom Hardy's big break. It helped launch Tom Hardy's career. He'd had a lot of smaller parts in films. This was his first lead role. Look, it's a film. It's an entertainment. It's there for people to enjoy. I know Charlie was pleased with the interpretation and the way it came across, but it was written in a particular way. And as I said, it was very like a Clockwork Orange. It was, you know, filmed in that particular way. It almost accentuates the madness. You know what I mean? It's, you know, Charlie's been in, you know, Broadmoor and injected with God knows what over the years, and been in Rampton, being, you know, injected with God knows what, and they're beaten, come across, you know, so many weird characters that the madness, I think, had to come out. And, you know, it's a film. I enjoyed it as a film. I haven't watched it.
Like
again.
Black comedy in it, like...
Yeah.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Exactly the same.
Like
exactly the same. It's got to accentuate the madness, because I don't think people would understand it if you just had Charlie in there and if they'd filmed it like, you know, McVicar, which is a great film, Roger Daltrey.
Yeah.
If they'd filmed it like that and just had him, you know, carrying out that robbery that he did and then going inside and beating a load of screws up, I just don't think people would have found it as interesting. It was a good film for what the subject matter was about, you know.
Scum, another one.
Yeah, Scum again is a great film. It's lasted
old school, isn't it?
Yeah, it's lasted the course of time. It's an old school film, you know. And obviously, my friend Ray Burdus is in that as well. He plays a good part in that. But yeah, you've got, you know, you, you're going back to films again, but Legend, I didn't particularly enjoy that. I mean, that originally was supposed to be Freddie Foreman's life story, but the deal collapsed around Fred, and they had to go and look for another angle. So they decided to do a Crazy film again. They got Tom Hardy on board, of course.
Is that the one who played both?
I thought, to be honest, I mean, we were lucky enough, myself, Christian, who's Fred's godson, and Fred were invited by Tom Hardy to the premiere. So we went to the premiere. Yeah. I've got to be honest, he nailed Reg. I thought he did a fantastic job of Reg. I met Ron. I've got to be honest, I thought he's an actor. He picked his own interpretation. It was very over the top and very, you know, very dramatic. And, you know, it was funny. It was like a comical character.
Yeah.
I think Ron should have been a lot more quieter and, you know, sedate. I mean, Ron was... essentially, you know, he was mentally ill. He was a paranoid schizophrenic, something which wasn't easily diagnosed in those days. He was on Stematol from an early age, and with Stematol you were never supposed to mix it with alcohol or any other drugs. And
I think they injected comedy into it. It's not necessarily a comedy movie, is it?
No,
you know what I mean.
Ron was very quiet. They were both very quietly spoken. I mean, There's not a great deal out there of them. But if you go onto YouTube, the interview on the BBC, that's how Ron was still speaking, even in Broadmoor days. Very quiet. My name's Ronnie Cryer.
Every day,
how are you? And it was like that was it. There was no loud brashness. You would never see. And I've heard this from Charlie. I've heard it from Fred. You never saw him. You would hear him. He would lose his temper with Reg. He'd have screaming rows with Reg. But he would never. He would never be openly, you know, gay. He would never talk about his sexuality in front of people. He was never that over the top with his gayness, you know.
Yeah, they made it over flamboyant.
Yeah, over flamboyant. And you know, that's down to the director and it's down to the characterisation. But as I say, getting back to the way he played Reg, I thought he nailed Reg. And Reg was still very like that in prison. I mean, he always had a deaf side, Reg. So I always used to laugh or go down on various visits with him. If he got put on one side, I knew he didn't want to speak to that person because he couldn't hear in his left ear, you know.
Oh, right.
Gay on the right side, that was the person he wanted to speak to, you know. But he was like a celebrity in prison, you know. You go into Maidstone, Nottingham in particular, where he had the run of the place, and you know, he'd have tables pulled together, he'd have 12 people sitting round and absolutely mental. But then he would go off, you know, you'd go on a visit to see him and he'd be walking across to the far end and speaking to somebody with, you know, down there, and go over. You'd spend half an hour waiting for him to come back, you know.
He'd have the run of the mill.
Like a celebrity. But yeah.
A lot of celebrities is like a, they love him, don't they? Like Barbara Windsor, and I mean, there's a whole list of them.
Yeah.
Well, I've got nothing but good things to say about the craze.
Well, like you're saying with the Bronson film, you know, the interpretation, like, at least Charlie was happy with it, but, you know, it's down to personal taste whether you enjoyed that or not, you know. Some of these lower budget Cray films are, you know, they're not really worth watching, you know.
So we've gone over to the Crays then. How did your relationship with the Crays come about?
Really through school. I passed an English exam at school studying Profession of Violence by John Pearson. My English teacher, Peter Yates, came in third year. I was on course to fail everything at school. As I said, my mum and dad had put us into private school because I couldn't read or write in the first 2 years of junior school. And it did pull us back on track, but not in the right areas. And I was on course to fail everything until that English teacher came in. And then I was doing the first year of GCSE, so he allowed me to study Profession of Violence as part of the curriculum. I was allowed to pick two books. So I picked that and I picked Day of the Triffids by John Wyndham. I was also studying The Crucible by Arthur Miller and Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. So, and Macbeth for Shakespeare. So
that's
studying,
deep for 13-year-old. Well,
I studying all these books. I was 15 at this point. All right. So this is like, I was like literally a last minute addition was this Professional Violence.
Still pretty
book.
Deep though.
I Very, like, oh yeah, definitely. I mean, a lot of different
it's
things.
It's about
there.
For Fox to fucking score.
But I wrote to the Crays afterwards and just said, look, you know, I wrote to Reggie first and said, I passed my English exam studying your life story. And I just wanted to say, although you've had a, you know, you've ended up in prison and, you know, you committed those crimes, I've passed my English exam studying a book about your life. And I wrote the same letter to Ron. And within a couple of days, I had letters back and a pen pal relationship had started up. You know, I contacted a young lad who I'd seen in Take a Break magazine, Brad Lane, who was Reggie's adopted son, who, you know, basically had a lot of Cray memorabilia that Reg had allowed him to keep. He had the wedding photos, they had Francis's engagement ring, and they lived in Doncaster. And I ended up going down to visit them a few months later, and basically, Reg rang that day while I was there, and I spoke to Reggie Cray on the phone, and he went, you must be Steve from Newcastle. And I was like, yeah, yeah. And we had a little chat, and we talked football, actually. I remember him mentioning I'm a Newcastle fan. He's an Arsenal fan. And, you know, he says, do you go to the games? And you'll have to come and see us. And that was where the relationship started. And a couple of weeks later, I was on my way to Gartree Prison to meet him.
Wow.
And that was a bizarre journey for me. I got a train from Newcastle to Doncaster, which is where Brad and Kim lived. Kim was Brad's mother. And we drove down to Gartree from there. And, you know, foreboding for me to go into a prison. Never been to one before. Just remember going in and, you know, having to sign in and security and show me ID and then going through being searched and the sniffer dogs and then walk through these huge gates and, you know, then walking into this huge visiting area, which was, you know, we were late on the visit, going into the middle of the room, which is where Reg and Ron always used to like to sit respectively in their different places, Broadmoor and Gartree at the time. And just the noise, it was just like a canteen, you know, and prisoners getting visits of their family, kids running around. And then just Reg appearing from the far end of the room through the door, you know, obviously from the cells, walking up to us. And, you know, he was in a regulation blue and white striped prison shirt, pair of jeans, big crucifix around his neck, pair of high-tech trainers. And, you know, just physically strong. He just won the, just lifted the most bench in Gartree. He'd just broken the record again in Gartree. He was 56, 57 at the time when I met him. So he was physically strong and vice-like grip. And it was just great. I mean, just a good visit. He was, you could see straight away that he was, you know, constantly thinking about business ideas. He pulled out a load of paper from his pocket and put it on the table, and there's loads of scrunched up paper, and he's opening them all up, and there's loads of ideas that he had for Kim, what he wanted her to do. And you need to ring this person. Can you send a check to that person? Can you do this? Have you given them a book? Have they got a calendar? Have you spoke to Ron? And it was just, his mind was 20 to the dozen on that visit. And a little bit of time for me. And just saying, he thought that I would be good for Brad because, you know, at the time I was coming up to like 16 and, you know, I think Brad was 11 at that point. He said that could be a good influence on Brad. And it was bizarre because at one point he was wanting us to move down there, you know, move away from my family at 16 and go and move in with Brad and Kim in Doncaster, you know, so I could be like a big brother to him. But it was just, you know, it was a bit surreal. But the last thing he said before I left on that first visit was that I had to go and see Ron, you know. So 2 weeks later, I was on my way down to Doncaster again to then travel from Doncaster to Crowthorne in Berkshire to go to Broadmoor to visit Ronnie Cray.
How does that feel as a teenager? You've read about these guys and now you're in a prison with him. Didn't that just blow your mind?
You know what? I never really give it an opportunity to blow my mind. I just went with the flow. I'd read about these people. I'd passed my English exam about them. I'd written to them for a reason because I wanted to...
You'd never expect to actually go and see him in prison, would you, from that?
Never 6 months later.
You'd be lucky to get a letter back. You'd be happy with that, wouldn't you, and quite content?
I mean, I became obsessed with them then. You know, I think it's a thing that a lot of blokes do. We all have an obsession. Do you know what I mean? Whatever it is, could be football, it could be, you know, it's usually sport, rugby or whatever, or like mine was at the time, Peter Beardsley, Chris Waddle and Kevin Keegan on the wall.
We admire them, don't you?
The Jam, Paul Weller in the Jam, Morrissey on my wall. And I started putting the Crays on my wall.
Yeah.
I had a photograph of the Crays on my wall, and then I had my letters, and I had the first couple of books that I'd bought. So then I'm on my way to visit them, so it becomes an interest. And I remember going into Broadmoor, and it was, my mum had warned us, because my mum worked in mental health. She'd been into places like that, and she said it'll be a lot different. You might see things that, you know, might be a bit unnerving or frightening, you know. It wasn't frightening, it was just, but she built it up to be something where I'm thinking, you know, I am going to be a bit more cautious. But it was a lot more relaxed. We got in, big Victorian building, went through the reception, you know, same kind of situation. But as we're walking through Broadmoor, you're actually walking through the ward, Henley Ward, which is what Ron was on, to get to this big, like, open room where there's a stage at one end where they put the Broadmoor productions on. So, you know, they get up, the patients, as they're called, get up and do performances, those who are inclined. But there's just, you know, a little canteen at the far end, and then just tables and chairs, nice conservatory at the back with the doors open, leaning into the gardens if you want to go in the gardens.
Prisoners then, no?
No, it's a hospital.
So
then Ron comes in dressed in a suit, you know, and he walked in late, like Reg had been. Yeah. We're sitting in the middle of the room again, and he walks in and he had a pretty, you know, smart suit on from Savile Row, white crisp shirt, still with the RK emblem.
Very nice.
Nice silk tie on with a tie pin in, pinky ring, which is worth about $2,000, pair of Gucci shoes on,
fucking
hell, gold horn rimmed glasses, walks in like that, sits at the table.
And he's the mental one.
And then shakes hands with me and shakes hands with Kim, and you know, gives Brad a cuddle, and then sits down and then just clicks his fingers, and straight away the nurse comes over. Yes, Ron, what can I get you? And he just, do you want anything to eat? Do you want a drink? And you know, and then he ordered a can of Calibre non-alcoholic lager and a packet of 20 cigarettes, and that was it. And basically that was what he used to do on every visit. You know, he'd hold court, he'd chain smoke his way through about 40 John Players. He would never smoke the full cigarette. And if you read the craze books, when he used to go socially, he always used to like to have a load of smoke around him. So that's what he was doing in Broadmoor. He's sitting in the centre of the room, holding court, chain smoking this cigarette, blowing it out, smoke all over the place, and just drinking non-alcoholic Calibre lager. But he was humorous. He was really interested in what we were up to. And, you know, I was naive in those days. You know, he was very quietly spoken. But at the end of the very first visit, he leaned in and he goes, "You don't mind that I'm bisexual, Steve, do you?" And I went, I says, "Not really, Ron." I says, "It's not for me." I says, "But," I says, "whatever you get up to and whatever I get up to, two completely different things." He's going, "Good, good." And that was it, you know. But he'd also talked about this infamous cruise now, and he just said, you know, again, completely naive. He says, "I'd love to take you on a cruise when I get out, Steve, you know, you and a couple of other friends of mine. And would you like to go on a cruise?" And I was going, "Well, yeah, it'd be great." So a couple of days later, after the visit, my mum shouts up the stairs. She goes, "Steve, some post for you." And, you know, come down the stairs, and it's this huge envelope. She went, "Don't know who this is. It's messy writing." Of course, it's Ronnie's, like, renowned scrawl. So I open the envelope and pull it out, and there it is, European Cruises, a full brochure, and then a little letter in from Ron saying, looking forward to the cruise, to let us know where you want to go. And it was just like, I've still got it to this day. A few years later, obviously, when he passed away in 95, my wreath was a cruise ship. Because obviously I'd grown older, I realised what on earth he was going on about. I mean, you know, it's one of them things when you're not that way inclined, you're not even thinking about that. But that was obviously what Ron obviously had, obviously had an eye for me at the time, and I hadn't really seen that, you know.
You don't even mind that, though, do you, really?
Well, it's a compliment, isn't it? It's a compliment. I've got to be honest, years later, when I was speaking to Maureen Flanagan, who used to go up, she was the Craze hairdresser, and she used to visit Ron quite a bit, and she used to say the ones he really fancied, he used to give a watch to. Now, I never got a watch to this day. Like,
so you end up in business with them?
Yeah, bizarre.
How does that start then, and what do you actually do for them?
Well, when I left school, I wanted to be an actor, and I'd basically gone to college and to try and make a little bit of money on the side. I was working at the family business, which was the post office and a news agent. But I was also designing T-shirts, and one of my friends could make the T-shirts up, but I was coming up with the design ideas. So, you know, we'd put Kevin Keegan, Peter Beardsley, Chris Waddle, and they were selling like hotcakes at, you know, various places in and around Newcastle.
Yeah.
And they were cheap to do, you know, just a white T-shirt, black image on, and, you know, sell them outside the ground, sell them in the shops for a commission, whatever, you know. So I said, why don't we do a one with a craze on?
Because I was obviously... They cost as much as of interest.
I was getting the T-shirts for about 90 pence at the time. So the
like
print,
Fruit of the Loom ones?
Yeah, basically that's what we're doing. And then you're getting the image on. That was the time-consuming part, and was costing us probably about £1.25 for the ink at the time.
Yeah.
So markup, we're selling the T-shirts at a tenner. So, you know, that was, you know, it was a good little earner for us on the football ones. Obviously, you know, we weren't paying for the images, but it was a nice little earner, and other people were trying the same. But
if you sold them around the grounds and that, wouldn't you get chased off?
No, not at those times. I mean, I was selling the fanzine as well around the ground. So you didn't. You, at that time, they weren't even strict on the licences. It was pretty quick. There was people selling tickets as well.
We used to get tickets, didn't we? We had tickets for the Stone Rose and that. We'd have them made up.
It's what you did to make a few.
You didn't stay around. You'd sell them and like think, all right, we better get off.
It's what you did to make a few quid. I mean, you know, I remember when Gazza left Newcastle, I went and bought 40 Mars bars when he came back to play Newcastle against Spurs the first game of the season.
Yeah.
So what I did was I went and bought 40 Mars bars and stuck them in the freezer, and then I sold them outside the ground for people to chuck at Gazza when he took a corner. So the Mars bars were, they were 10 pence a go, and I was selling them for a pound outside. So I made a fortune that day, you know. Like,
what's wrong,
you know,
with that?
Nah, good. I mean, 36 quid profit, you know what I mean? Back in 1988, it was a lot of money to me.
My friend used to print back in the day. He used to print it. It was like Donny and McKenzie and stuff like that. He'd have jumpers and like he'd give them to me and I'd sell them.
Yeah. But the T-shirt idea was a great one, and I just basically wrote to the Twins and said, look, would you be interested in having your image on the front of the T-shirt? Reg came back and said, yeah, we like the idea. 70% to us, 30% to you, and you do the, you know, you do the over, you take the risk with the overheads. Sounds like a bad deal, really, but it's 35% to Reg, 35% to Ron, and 30% to us, which was like 15% each for me and Mark at the time. So that's what we did. We went with it. And the one,
if you were taking the risk, I think it would have gone 50-50.
He wouldn't do it, though. He wanted it, he wanted Ron cutting on it, and yeah, it was fair enough. So, and it wasn't what only line. If it had been what only line, we probably would have gone for a harder bargain.
Yeah.
But I just thought, look, it's worth it, and we'll give it a go, and they might not work. So I persuaded Mark to do it. He said, yeah, good idea. So we went with Professional Violence, Ron and Reg's face, and Professional Violence at the top. And that was it, just a simple
Well, if you hadn't have asked, you could have got sued, couldn't
well,
you?
Yeah, well, we still could have got sued because we didn't. Because David, yeah. David Bailey did come to us a few years later when I wrote my book and put the story in and
Obviously.
Said, I hope you're not still doing those T-shirts. I've still got the letter where your solicitor contacted us and said, don't be doing any more of those T-shirts. which was funny. Gave us a bit of publicity for the book anyway. But yeah, we did the T-shirts.
How did you sell them?
Went again basically through the shops that we'd used. There was a shop in Newcastle called Pet Sounds, which was like a record shop which used to sell T-shirts, and they would deal with independent like traders like us, which is what we were. So they took it in, and we just started off with 10, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then he wanted another 10 the week later, and he says, they're selling like hotcakes, these, we'll do another 20. I'll put you in touch with the store in Sunderland, I'll put you in touch, you know, and basically just putting us in touch with different people who he knew who were doing T-shirts. Quayside Market, again, where I'd originally bought the Craze book, somebody wanted some down there. So it's just getting them to the people, and, you know, it became like a little cottage industry, really, you know. Mm-hmm. The Craze were making money, we were making money.
I've got T-shirts out now, but obviously, they're more expensive, but it would be. You're talking a few years ago, weren't you?
Yeah, yeah. But it was one of them things. Lads like to wear T-shirts, different types of T-shirts with people on. So we were probably ahead of our time, because years later, there was people, Ringspun came out with a whole load of, you know, crime faces on their, on their T-shirts. But we did really well, and we started getting further afield. It was without the internet, so it was all phone calls and, you know, maybe a letter. You know, in the post, believe it or not. But, you know, people contacting us and saying, can you do this? And then Reg was getting onto us saying, such and such wants some T-shirts, can you get in touch with them? So his connections were far and wide as well. So, you know, it became a really good business, profitable for us. You know, with the help of Steph King in Nottingham, she was doing other stuff.
They're helping you sell too. Yeah, you might only be getting a third of it, but a third of... Something's better than a third of
exactly,
nothing, isn't it? You know what I mean?
So it got as far as Croydon, and then somebody said no. And, like, obviously we're wondering, well, why won't this person take them? Reg wanted us to, like, look into it, why won't this shop take them?
Yeah.
We got all the way around the houses and eventually got told to ring this antique shop up on a Wednesday afternoon, speak to the guy. This is the guy who deals with the orders down there. Apparently they're already getting crate T-shirts and they don't want yours. So that was it. Rang this shop 2 o'clock on the Wednesday afternoon, and bloke picks the phone up and it's Charlie Cray. He's the one who's putting T-shirts in down in London.
You can't really tell him to stop then, can you?
The older brother.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he's doing it without the twins' permission. So this is the first time that I've had to go back to them and say, we can't get T-shirts into this particular place. Well, why? Well, because your brother Charlie's putting T-shirts in. Well, that was it. Holy hell broke out. They wouldn't speak to him for 12 months. So the next 12 months, I've got letters stemming back from that period, basically calling Charlie Mr. X. Have you heard of anything of Mr. X? They wouldn't even call him Cray because they were that annoyed with him. And this came off the back of the film. You know, he'd allegedly, you know, took a better deal on the film. He'd signed up not just for the film rights, but he'd also signed up for the videotapes rights at the time, and he got a little bit extra out of the film. And they were always falling out with Charlie. They always had issues with him at some point, and this was just another one of those issues. And
was Charlie more of a businessman then?
Charlie was always getting into schemes with people. I wouldn't say that he was a businessman. He was just somebody who would, you know, he just lived the life, you know what I mean? He was living off the name. He would never change his name.
Yeah.
He constantly supported the Twins. He would go on to TV, especially after the film in 1990. There was a lot more publicity surrounding them. He would go on to documentaries and chat shows and defend the Twins. And
but if he wasn't the Cray, would he have made it on his own?
I think so. Yeah, I think he could have done. I think he could have gone into different lines of work. There's no doubt about it. But you know, he just got into that routine where he was just happy being a Cray and just living off the name. You know what I mean? And he would go to places. He would never have to put his hand in his pocket. He would turn up at the Cray charity events, and you know, he'd get drunk as everyone was buying him a drink. But was he a villain? Were the Crays really villains? You know, I wasn't around in the 60s, but everything you hear from the respected villains of that day were they weren't really. They were hard. There were people that could have a fight. They could bully people. They could beat people up. No doubt about
that.
They
were more Robin Hoods, weren't they?
But they were probably the less polite way of calling them as thieves' ponces, is what a lot of people describe them.
Yeah.
You know, if you did a job on their manor, then they'd come along and knock on your door and say, where's our percentage?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's what they were renowned for. Ultimately, their downfall was killing Jack the Hat, breaking Frank Mitchell out of prison, killing George Cornell in front of witnesses, getting their hands dirty, which, the, you know, real mafia people probably wouldn't do.
Cornell was crazy.
But then, obviously, they also were victims of their own stardom. You know, they courted the press from an early age, you know, because they were twins. But then subsequently being involved in the David Bailey photo shoot, and, you know, it just jettisoned them into this, like, public persona and eventually getting involved with the politics.
But it made him lovable because they loved the mum. You can see that.
But the biggest downfall was getting involved with the politicians as well. Of course. Booth being Dryburgh, you know, people on different sides of the house in Westminster and the government must be looking, going, what on earth are these politicians doing? And that was always the get out of jail card. Yeah. That they always thought that the footage and the photographs that they had of politicians in compromising positions was going to get them out of jail. Sadly, when the doors went through in 68 for them, Charlie made a phone call to tell the person who was looking after these to get rid of them because the house was going to get raided. So this person, instead of getting rid of them into another house, burnt them. So all the cine tape and all the film went up. Everything that could have got them reduced sentences at the very least
went up
in flames, and the Crays ended up dying in prison.
I'd tell Sean, because he's slagging the royal family off all the time on Triple Class, and I'd tell him Epstein, you know, one of these days you're going to be walking home from down London, some guys are just going to get you, put you in your car, and you'll be gone. It happens.
Well, it does. I mean, you know, you look at what goes on. You look at what goes on, and you know, there's a lot of stuff goes on behind the scenes.
I personally don't agree with Sean's theory on that. By the way, I love the royal family.
God save the Queen.
God save the Queen.
So we had Chris Lambriano on, and mm-hmm. he gave his story of Jack the Hat. Why did Jack the Hat have to go? What happened?
He really was, you know, silly in his dealings with the Crays. From his perspective, he probably thought he was doing the right thing. He was on uppers and downers.
He was the mouthy one, wasn't he?
He's on uppers and downers, but he's a hard man. He's not like the character that Tom Bell portrays in the 1990 film. I mean, he was 6'2". He was the same height as us. Big, thick set guy. A hired thug, really, is probably the best way to describe him. A very hard man.
See, I thought he'd come across more as like a smug little rat.
He's not like you see, that's the Tom Bell portrayal is not very, it's a great portrayal, but it's not of Jack the Hat.
Yeah.
You know, he's a big, physically strong lad who his party piece used to be walking on his hands. Physically strong, yeah. Obviously got the nickname because of the bald patch under his hat. But he was essentially given a job by the Twins, which was to basically kill Leslie Payne. Leslie Payne was Payne the brain. He was the businessman of the Crays firm. He was the one who set the long firm frauds up. So the person who did the Crays accounts and did the best deals for them, you know. And he essentially was starting to get on the firm's nerves. Ron was starting to fall out with him, not trust him, getting paranoid, and he wanted him out of the way. You know, Jack the Hat was given the job essentially of going and assassinating him. So what he does on this particular night, he's paid 50% up front and he's going to get 50% on completion of the job. He goes to the house, he knocks on the front door. Payne, who's paranoid anyway and thinks that he's going to get, you know, he's going to be on this list and he's going to get hit, sends his wife to the door. His wife goes to the door.
What a gentleman.
His wife basically says, I'm sorry, he's not in. And that's it. And Jack goes off. So,
wow.
He doesn't do the job. He spends the money, goes and gets drunk, buys pills, and you know, basically the twins find out about this and they're not very happy, you know.
So, as you would be, wouldn't you?
So Jack, you know, Jack's, you know, Jack is given more than one chance, but obviously then mucks up again. And from the Craze perspective, you know, they're not thinking straight. Reggie's distraught, obviously, and not thinking straight after Francis has committed suicide. Ron is a paranoid schizophrenic who's completely out of control. So the order's given really to kill Jack. Jack comes down to the Regency nightclub, shoots, you know, with a gun, intending on shooting Reg before he kills him. The doorman stops him at the door. And the gun goes off and shoots into the front of the Regency. Reg and Ron are completely unaware of this until the next day. And once they hear that Jack's come down and trying to kill them, the order's given to get rid of Jack. And that's it. So right. they set it up at the flat. You know, it's set up at the flat. The Lambrianos are obviously given the job of, you know, basically bringing Jack to the flat, unbeknown to them that this is going to happen. Ron is obviously urging Reg to do his, because he's killed Cornell. You need to do yours. And he's presented with a gun. It's a long-running thing with the Craze that whoever their armourer wasn't very good, because the guns never seemed to work. They always seemed to jam or misfire. Yeah. They weren't top-notch guns, apart from the one that killed Cornell, of course. But the gun that Reg obviously has when he's brought into the living room jams. And, you know, in the melee, he's presented with a knife in a struggle and stabs Jack the Hat to death. And I spoke, you know, obviously spoke to Reg on, you know, numerous occasions about a lot of things. And, you know, we did speak about the Jack the Hat murder when we were in prison. And, you know, he did have remorse for it, but he never wanted to show remorse. In his mind, Jack the Hat was going to kill him. And he said, it was kill or be killed. And he said, for me, that is the reason that I killed him. He had more remorse about what had happened with Francis than he did anything else. The fact that Francis had, you know, she died. And, you know, he loved Francis. You know, to one person he spoke about more on visits than anybody else, and was Francis, and he had a deep love for her. And I think that's such a shame for Reg, because I think to me it was obvious that he battled with his sexuality throughout his life. I do believe that Reg was gay or bisexual at the very least, but I'll never have proof of that. I'm sure there's people who he shared intimacy with inside. You know, I have heard the tales from various people who've come out who've yet to break their silence on it, but have said that they've shared intimacy with him in jail. But at the end of the day, I think with Reg, I think, you know, his one true love was Francis. And I think he felt more regret about that than Jack the Hat, because, as he said, in our line of business, it was kill or be killed. And Jack the Hat was very capable of killing us.
Didn't they run the Italian mafia at all? Did the Mexican, the American mafia come over?
They did, but I think ultimately...
What was that story?
Well, there's a huge story in here. It's probably a lot bigger than the Craze. You know, the licensing laws changed in gambling, and the American mafia were very keen on getting across to the UK and getting their tentacles across on this side of the Atlantic.
I think the Peaky Blinders hit more of a serious note on that, don't they?
They touched on it. I mean, Peaky Blinders is fictional, but, you know, there's an element of truth within Peaky Blinders. You know, I'm a fan of the programme, but it's not quite as accurate, you know. The Mafia were very interested in coming across here, and they saw the Craze as an avenue for, you know, basically getting the, you know, getting their hands into the casinos and the one-armed bandits, etc. And not just in London, but stretching it out up and down the UK. And obviously at the time, the Craze were going out and doing tours with and events with the likes of George Raft, Joe Louis, Sonny Liston, these former boxers, and George Raft, the actor. And these people were good fronts. They would go in, they would put them into clubs. The Craze would be putting in X amount for the fee for the act, but they would be taking a bigger fee for themselves, so they were getting money out of it. Sometimes they went with them. I mean, it's the unique thing about the Craze coming to Newcastle. Neil Jackson and I did a documentary about it. They came to Newcastle. There's actually photographs of them there. We've sat and watched the cine film from the news with Ronnie Craze sitting in the front of the audience clapping as Joe Louis comes on to do a talk in the Dolce Vita nightclub in Newcastle. So it's all there. But yeah, it was a bigger thing. So yeah, the Craze did have meetings. Ronnie Craze did fly to New York. There's FBI files which you can get at the Public Records Office, which show you the FBI watching Ronnie Craze across there.
Wow.
But I think genuinely speaking, Ron's mental state was the thing that ultimately was the biggest flaw for the Americans. They couldn't really work with them. There was a deal with with Bearer Bonds, which Charlie was involved in. But the story with the mafia could have been so much bigger. But I just think that the Americans got a bit twitchy around the craze. And especially when, you know, Ron walked into the Blind Beggar and killed George Cornell. That was the beginning and the end for that. And they looked at other avenues.
Why did he whack
Cornell? Can't blame him, though. Can you to look at other avenues?
He whacked Cornell. It's well publicised because of the slur against his sexuality. You know, it's as simple as that. You know, there isn't another reason behind it. He there was an ongoing dispute between the Crays and the Richardsons. Something which obviously all came to a head at Mr. Smith's nightclub, where there was a big set to and a big fight.
Not the one in Warrington.
No, and obviously the Crays' cousin was killed at Mr. Smith's. And it was like almost like an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, you know.
Yeah.
But Ronnie had obviously also heard that Cornell was calling out his sexuality, and that was the reason that, you know, the reason...
Going puff to Wally, but on the movies it shows you calling it.
That's definitely part of it, but it's he didn't just shoot him because he called him a fat puff. He basically shot him because of the build-up. And obviously, one of the Crays' firm and one of the Crays' relatives has been killed in a nightclub. Then it's war, isn't it?
Puff is just icing on the cake, isn't it?
In his mind, he was like Genghis Khan. Do you know what I mean? Ronnie Cray, that's the kind of books he used to read. And for him, it was about a war, and you know, we've got to rid the Richardsons on the street. It's the reason they broke Frank Mitchell out of prison, because they wanted a big strapping guy. It was partly to do because Ronnie had served time with him and felt sorry for him. But he saw Frank Mitchell as a massive ally, you know, and if we could get him out of prison, he could be on our firm, and he could be, you know, he would terrify the Richardsons, you know. It was a bizarre way of thinking, and you know.
Well, I can see the point in that, though, because he was, I mean, from what you see of him, he was a huge guy, wasn't he?
He was, he was. But he wasn't thinking straight, you know, like a lot of things with Ronnie, you know, because of his illness, you know, he didn't think things through, and, you know, certainly didn't think straight about consequences, certainly, you know. I thought they were untouchable, really.
So which, out of the Cray movies, which one would you say portrays it most accurate?
1990, the Crays with the Kemps.
Yeah.
I mean, from a timeline perspective, again, it's a 2-hour film. You can't get everything right, you know. I mean, the Jack the Hat murder and the Cornell murder happened at completely different occasions, you know.
Yeah.
On the film, it gives the impression it happens on the same night. But I think it's a really good characterization. I think, you know, the Kemps did a really good job. I think, you know, with the exception of Tom Bell, really, I mean, great performance by Tom Bell, but Jack the Hat wasn't portrayed in the correct manner because of, you know, the physicality wasn't right. George Cornell, the Stephen Burkoff character, is fantastic. And of course, Billy Whitelaw as Violet, with the exception of the swearing, which of course the Crays took umbrage at, because the mother never swore. She really...
I was going to say that.
Fantastic performance by her in the film. But that's the best Cray film, I think, at the moment. Legend's good for its production value, but from a story point of view, it's horrendous. Reggie never beat Francis up. He never raped Francis. It never happened, you know.
No.
And I think that left a little bit of a sour taste in everybody's mouth, you know.
She was just depressed, wasn't she?
Yeah. And a very strong woman. Very strong. You know, portrayed as this timid creature. Yeah. But over the last few months, I've spoken to their family in quite depth.
A lot of people on them, though. It was like Valium, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Take Valium and gin.
Yeah.
Mother's Little Helpers.
100%, yeah. That's it, yeah.
Did they kill anyone else?
Reg always admits to killing one other. He did his deathbed interview on the BBC, when he got out of prison on compassionate grounds. But I always feel that it was Frank Mitchell that he was talking about. A lot of people felt it was Teddy Smith, but a good friend of mine, Ray Rose, an investigative journalist, actually tracked Teddy Smith down to Australia a few years ago before he died. Fair play to Teddy Smith. He just, you know, he managed to get out there and fly off and get away from the whole Cray madness and duck out of the police investigations and live a life on the other side of the world. And fair play to him, you know. He was probably hooked up with Lord Lucan. You know, that's come out in the last few weeks, isn't it? Lord Lucan's out in Australia. But I think it was Frank Mitchell. And although the Crays never pulled the trigger, I think Reg would always feel that he was culpable for that murder because he was the one who, you know, broke him out of prison, you know.
So what about Freddie Foreman then? What's his story?
Fred's a man in his own right. I mean, you know, as I say, we're busy trying to get Fred's film together now. The first draft of the script's been written by Ray Burdus. The second draft will be written this year. Fred's been a good friend of mine for what, 25 years now.
Wow.
I met him in 1995. I met him at Ronnie Cray's funeral. I met him at the wake at the Governor's Pub. And Charlie Cray introduced me to him. And he was basically on day release for the funeral. If you remember Ron's funeral, the pallbearers were from north, south, east and west. So Freddie represented South London. And we got on well that day. We had a little chat. We shared a drink. And then he had to get back off to the Nick. He was serving his final few days in prison before he came out for good. He was in for handling the Security Express robbery. And then over the course of the time, we just got to know each other. I was up and down to London quite a bit. I got to meet various characters, went to various events. I'd be invited to birthday parties. So I was invited to charity events. And, you know, as Fred got himself back into society, I got to know him. His godson, Christian, had moved from Australia back to England. And I got to know him very well. And he was the same age as me. So we socialised together, as did Joe Pyle Jr. and Jamie Foreman. So the four of us were quite a team. We're all the same age. All go out and drink together, party together, go to clubs together.
I can't believe how old you are. I thought you were about 23.
I'm 48. They're 48 this month.
You're looking young.
Thank you. It's late nights. And I mean, for me, it was just those nights were just great, great times. We used to, and we were always welcomed by the chaps, you know. So we would spend a bit of time at the Monday Club, which was down in the Elephant and Castle.
Sleep through the day up all night.
We used to do that on weekends at the Ministry of Sound, yeah. Or go to the leisure lounges on a Sunday night and finish at 9 a.m. But the Monday Club was always good because it was like literally all the old villains would go down there. There was Joe Pyle Sr., Freddie Foreman, Frankie Fraser. So this is when they were all getting on, of course. Tommy Wisby, Bruce Reynolds, whoever would be down there. Dave Courtney would pop down, me, Christian, Jamie Foreman, Joe Pyle Jr. would all go down to the Monday Club and just have a 20 quid in the jar each, and essentially the drinks were covered all night, you know what I mean? And sometimes we didn't have to put it in. If somebody'd had a touch, maybe there was a freebie for the youngins, we'd have a free drink. But it was just unique times, you know, going down to see all those people. Roy Shaw would come along as well, and then we'd go from there to, you know, maybe the casino in Leicester Square, and, you know, maybe have something to eat. They'd go on the roulette tables or stuff, and we just had some, you know.
I bet a lot of the times the older people put it in for you as well, didn't they?
They did, and we were in awe of them, you know what I mean, because they were like old school. And for me, it was a bit weird because, again, you know, I'm not a villain. I was a doorman in Newcastle, you know.
Yeah.
I'd gone into the family business, which was newsagents in the post office as well, so I was still doing shifts in there. But I spent a lot of time down there. I had a girlfriend in London as well, so I was seeing quite a bit of
her. I bet the post office was just as stressful too, especially on gyro days.
That was a nightmare, really, but it was... I think for me, it was... It just proves, like, for me that I'm just dealing with the general public.
Yeah.
That's how I can, you know, subsequently what I've ended up doing in my life.
Was it still when people got like a green gyro?
Yeah, yeah.
Come in with the family book.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, but all of that, like, so, you know, essentially working with the general public was, you know, was a natural thing to me at a young age in the post office and the news agents. Then to go from that into the door, working with people and having a conversation with people, it was easy, you know.
Every 3 months I'd say, must be gyro and get another one.
But it's like, it was like a split personality, it was like a split life, because then I'm going from, you know, my daytime job and my nighttime job in Newcastle, and then maybe jumping on the clipper or jumping on the train and going down to London and being part of this world where I'm putting a suit on and, you know, just, you know, having a drink with them. And I was spending more time with these old villains than I was with my friends in Newcastle, which is bizarre. But, you know, it was what I wanted to do.
Did you know Arnold, did it?
I don't regret doing it at all. No, I made some really good contacts through them, you know. And they opened the doors. Dave Courtney especially, because he was, you know, 10 years older than me. He opened the door for me in London a lot, you know, nightclubs, bars. And
I've met him, sure.
Subsequently let him work.
I sent you his books while you were in prison about raving and doorman, and he had like the most doormen working for him in London at one point in time. Army of fucking doormen.
An army of doormen, yeah.
Yeah, he's very funny. You would have a good banter with him, I reckon. Mm-hmm. What were the biggest stories in Freddie Foreman's life then?
Poor. I mean, Fred, you know, Fred was renowned on the pavement, really. You know, he was a good robber, you know, and you know, a lot of the stories you can't really tell, you know, for Fred. You know, obviously he was found guilty in the murder of Jack the Hat, something which had nothing to do with him whatsoever. He literally was dragged into that whole case because Charlie Cray had told him what the twins had done, and the twins basically, after the body had been wrapped up in a blanket and stuck in a car, was driven to the south side of the river and dumped on Fred's manor. Some might say that the twins were trying to set Fred up.
So was Freddie part of a different farm?
Fred was never on the Cray firm. Fred was always his own man. You know, Fred was always an independent. He had a lot of friends. They were all very good at their particular jobs, and he was very good at getting money.
They lived in a different part of London, didn't they?
South London was Fred. The twins were the East End of London.
Yeah.
The reason that Fred ended up getting weighed in with the twins was because of his relationship with Charlie. Charlie Cray and Freddie were very good friends.
Yeah.
Good pals. And, you know, basically Fred came along and you know, basically because he was friends with Charlie, ended up cleaning up after the twins. And it's his biggest regret. I mean, he said it himself on the documentary. We produced a documentary with Salon Pictures and Lionsgate a couple of years ago called Fred. And it's like it was Fred's final documentary. He wanted one last documentary to get his views out. And he says it's the biggest regret he's ever getting involved with him. But he served time for the Jack the Hat. He did a 10 stretch for that. Basically knowingly being involved, you know, the disposal of the body kind of thing. And then he was pulled in on the Frank Mitchell case, of course, as well. But, you know, that was chucked out. No one was ever found guilty of Frank Mitchell's murder. But then subsequently from there, you know, he did another 9 for the handling of the Security Express robbery money. So with Fred, there's a lot of stories out there which, you know, have been told. He's one of the most respected people in crime in the UK.
Is he a knockout merchant or a shooter?
No comment, really. I can't really comment on that because I was never around to see him. But from my perspective, all I need to say is the most respected person in crime that I know. You know, I've met a lot of the big hitters. And, you know, there's Freddie and there's probably Joe Pyle Senior in London who I would say were the big names in London. You know, the Cray's got all the publicity, but you know, Freddie was the main man.
Well, if he's watching, he wants to get his views out on YouTube.
I can always speak to him. I was speaking to him last night. With Fred, he's always very careful about what he does. He's you know, he's 88 this year. He's happy with his life. It took a bit of persuading to get him to do this final documentary, but he did want to get out there and do it. And, you know, if people get a chance to watch it, it's just called Fred. And it's a very open and honest documentary about Fred's life, but where he's at the moment, you know. And as I say, I've got a lot of time and respect for Fred and always will do.
What was the robbery you mentioned that they roped him into?
No, Fred was involved in the handling of the Security Express money. So if you Google the Security Express robbery, you'll find out all the details on that you need to. That was, you know, a very, very big robbery in its day.
Okay. Any final stories you'd like to say in conclusion?
I think probably the only person we haven't touched on is Paul Ferris.
Oh, yeah.
Paul Ferris, the wee man. Somebody who I'd spoken to on the phone. I'd done an interview. I used to write for Loaded magazine. I used to do the crime stories in there. And I'd done a one on the mafia in Aberdeen, of all places. It was one of the most intriguing things that I'd ever had to do. I'd been told that the mafia were running out of a restaurant in Aberdeen, and sure enough, they were. You know, I did the digging up on them, and the guy had just been arrested, and they'd actually put this guy from Italy into Aberdeen, and it was like a middle ground for like drugs and, you know, you name it. And so I did this article, and then in this magazine there was a piece on Paul Ferris, and I thought I'd love to do something like with him, you know, it'd be nice to interview him. And of course the Wee Man was coming out, and I'd spoken to my friend Brian Anderson, who was a photographer who'd done a book called Faces a few years previous. And he said he would get us an introduction. And when the film came out, I interviewed him for Loaded magazine. We just did it on the phone. But he was pleased with the interview. He said, you know, once he read it back, he rang us up and said, look, you know, thanks very much for not misquoting us, not putting anything in that shouldn't have been in. And, you know, we'll have to meet up at some point. And about a year later, I was up in Scotland. Brian took us up to meet him. And, you know, we basically had lunch. I went up to Scotland, had a haggis for the first time in my life.
What was it like?
In Scotland, do what the jocks do.
Black pudding?
I actually enjoyed it. It's a bit like black pudding, yeah. But it's like mince, like a bit like a mince. It's difficult to explain, and I wouldn't want to make one.
Like a faggot?
No way. Cornell got shot for worse than that.
You're like a savoury ball.
Like that. It is like that. It's, you know, ultimately it was nice. I would eat it again, but we just had a nice civilised lunch. We had a chat. And at the end of the conversation, I just said, have you ever thought about doing any more books?
Mm.
And he went, Nah, not really. You know, he says that, you know, obviously worked a lot with the respected journalist Reg Mackay. And the books, the book Vendetta and the Ferris Conspiracy, I don't know whether you've read them. They're great books, great reads. A lot about police corruption and about being fitted up. And when I read the book, I was like, it would be good to do something with Paul at some point. And that's why I suggested it to him. And he said, well, what kind of angle would you go at? And I said, well, we'll do a tribute to Reg, you know. He said, well, let us think about it. And I planted the seed. 6 months later, he came back and said, I'd love to do it. I think it's a great idea. So that's what we did. We sat down. Most difficult book I've had to write, really, because he's done so many good books, and you're trying to find a new angle. You're trying to find you're trying to find a different angle, covering somebody who's written three best-selling books and still make it interesting.
Yeah.
But what we managed to do, me and my co-author with Paul, was to get the best out of him. I sat and did the interviews, and then the co-author of the book, basically had like a wall. It was a bit like a crime wall, really. It had stickers all over the wall, different things that he could look at and how it would tie in. And it worked. The book is actually Unfinished Business. If you picked it up now, it would make sense reading it if you read that before you read one of Reg's books. So it doesn't give the story away from Reg's books, but it still it still makes sense. If that makes sense. So it fits perfectly. And we're really happy with it because it gave us an opportunity to work with him and do something, but it was the biggest challenge we had for actually writing the book, you know?
Do you have an ideal length of the book, what you think's the best? Like 300 pages
yeah. is right. 300, you're looking for 90,000 words for a good book, and 300 pages.
It's like 560, 600 is too much, and 200 is not enough.
It's too much because it's too much for printing costs. It comes down to being a financial decision. Do you know what I mean? But 300 pages is about right. I'm always a stickler. I'd like to have photos in a book.
Doesn't that cost more?
It does, but. I want to know if I'm reading about your life.
I always flip to the photos first, me though. I'll read the book, but I want to flip to the photos first.
But when you're looking at stuff, you want to look at it and go, bang, that's who that is. That's who that is. It puts a name to a face, rather than leaving it to somebody's imagination. So it's a lot better, you know.
Yeah.
But that's been great. And I mean, obviously, from my perspective, it's now about finding the next books. We're in talks with a couple of people at the minute. There's one book in particular, which I think will come off, which I can't say at the moment. But I think if that comes off, that will blow a few conspiracy theories away about various things. And obviously, I'm concentrating on the acting work now. Working with Stephen on the Sayers film, going to play Stephen Sayers in the Sayers film. I went through the whole casting process with Gary Fraser, which was great. But I had a degree of success in recent times, did Rise of the Foot Soldier 3, just done the new Quadrophenia film called To Be Someone with Ray Burdus. So it's been
on a roll, aren't you?
I hope so, yeah. I hope so. Coming on to something like this is great for me. I mean, obviously I watch Sean's podcasts and your podcast with interest and watch James English's stuff as well. So to be able to come out and, maybe show people a little bit more about Steve Wraith, because I'm an unknown quantity to a lot of people.
Yeah.
To actually put myself out there and people to see who I am instead of just a name. It dispels a few of the myths, I think, as well.
Well, I think people should hear your story before they know your name anyway, so they know you now, you know what I mean?
It's just good.
Or do they know more of you?
Yeah.
Appreciate you sharing your story, man. That bouncer stuff was just fucking fascinating. That was like, it was brilliant.
Nice to talk about something which isn't the craze. I mean, the craze is great and it's a relevant part of my life. And I think when you look at the craze books... the craze were interested in celebrity and they spent a lot of time with famous people. I've done that with the shows that I've done. I'm putting a show on with Floyd Mayweather next month in Newcastle. But I've worked with Tyson and Holyfield, you name it, the big fighters. The craze work with boxers. I've become a professional boxing promoter and worked on the unlicensed boxing game, something for another podcast perhaps. But it's, I've followed the craze and followed in their example, but without the crime. And I think, the fact that Reg and Ron both said it was on numerous occasions on visits, don't ever copy us, don't follow in our footsteps. Wise words from them, which I've always listened to.
And are you sure you're not a master criminal who just never got caught?
100%. Only in films. Only in films.
So people who want to contact you and support you, who've enjoyed this today, what's your preferred way of getting in touch?
Got a couple of websites, www.badboysbooks.net, which is where you can buy all of our books.
This will all be in the description box below the video.
NewcastleLegends.com is our events management page. But on Facebook, I've got a Steve Wraith's True Crime page is probably the best place to visit, because we've set that up. It's a nice little community, you know, where we basically just share true crime stories and podcasts like yourself, and obviously the Sayers group as well, which is obviously going to have a lot of stuff on about the film, and the Sayers film page on Facebook. So they're all on Facebook, but easily contactable on Facebook and at Steve Wraith on Twitter, WRAITH.
So if you've enjoyed this, please click down in the description box. You can get the books, and you can also go on Facebook or message Steve on Facebook. Huge thank you to all new subscribers. If you're not subscribed yet, the subscription logo is down there, bottom right-hand corner. Huge thank you to all people who've donated on PayPal, Patreon, Just Giving, Subscribestar, enabling us to produce these podcasts in studios with cameramen, sound engineers, and get great guests in here like Steve. And please put your questions and comments also in the you know, comment section below this video. And cheers from Liverpool for now.
And trolls, go and fuck yourselves.
Thanks, man.
Cheers, mate.
Yeah, brilliant. Top well man. Done. Thank you.
Thanks, mate.
Bye, mate.
Top man.